This is the Quality News Network. Florida's Gulf Coast is under a hurricane warning as Alberto, the first tropical storm of the season, has quickly and unexpectedly strengthened. Forecasters are warning the storm threatens to dump heavy rain on the state by tomorrow. At Camp David today, President Bush is meeting with military and civilian national security leaders to discuss future troop levels in Iraq. Top commanders in Iraq are participating through video conference. The meetings continue tomorrow. The U.S. military has released the results of the autopsy of al-Qaeda in Iraq leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was killed Wednesday. It confirms that he survived the bombings but died about an hour later from massive internal injuries of the blast. Also today, in an online statement, al-Qaeda in Iraq posted the name of the group's new leader. Northeast of Baghdad today, a U.S.-led raid and firefight killed 9 people, including 7 al-Qaeda-linked insurgents. It occurred near the area where al-Zarqawi was killed. In Baghdad, U.S. and Iraqi authorities have released 200 more prisoners. It's part of an ongoing effort to promote national unity. In Washington today, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that death row inmates can challenge the use of lethal injections as an execution method. The justices said that the claims that the chemicals used are too powerful could be a violation of the Eighth Amendment, which protects against cruel and unusual punishment. At Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, domestic and international pressure is increasing to shut down the prison. This follows the suicides of 3 detainees over the weekend. In Washington, critics and supporters of the government's domestic surveillance program were in court today to argue its constitutionality. Opponents claim it violates the rights of free speech and privacy. The Bush administration says it is necessary in the fight against terrorism. The FBI reports that the number of violent crimes in the U.S. increased 2.5% last year, the first rise in 5 years. Houston, Philadelphia, and Las Vegas were cities reporting the largest jump in murders. On Capitol Hill, West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd is now the longest-serving senator in U.S. history. He was first elected when Dwight D. Eisenhower was president. In Reno, Nevada today, a family court judge was shot at the county courthouse. There's no word on his condition. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Most people would rather have a root canal than go to a dealer to buy a car. But you can turn dread into joy when you learn how to play the car buying game. Read the book, Right Car, Right Price, and you'll discover how the game is played and how you can win every time. Whether you're buying a car or a truck, new or used, Right Car, Right Price explains how to find and buy the vehicle best suited to your individual transportation needs. Auto Week called Right Car, Right Price the right stuff. So take the hassle out of car buying. Read Right Car, Right Price, and every time you get into your new car, you'll know you've got a great deal. Go online to rightcarrightprice.com to order your copy today. It only takes an hour to read Right Car, Right Price, and it just costs $10. We even pay the postage. So go to rightcarrightprice.com right now. It'll be one of the best decisions you ever make.
Microsoft has announced it is releasing 12 security patches tomorrow as part of its monthly security updates. Some of those carry a critical rating, which is the highest risk. Verizon Wireless plans to launch a service today that lets parents check their children's whereabouts and alerts them when they venture out of bounds. Some students are finding a way to use their cell phones in class without the teacher knowing. A new ringtone downloaded off the internet is too high-pitched for most adults to hear. A research firm says global demand for broadband is growing and the days of dial-up internet access are almost over. The study predicts that broadband subscriptions will reach 400 million by 2010. Some political analysts are calling this weekend's convention of some 900 blogging activists as the most significant political gathering of the year. The yearly COSE convention was held in Las Vegas and featured many congressional and possible presidential candidates. Seattle is considered the smartest city, according to a survey by BizJournals.com. The ranking is based on the highest concentration of brain power. 47% of adults in Seattle have a bachelor's degree. U.S. gasoline prices have remained stable over the last 3 weeks. The average price for a gallon of unleaded is $2.93. Light sweet crude is trading at $70.36 a barrel today. And on Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is down 100 points. The Nasdaq is down 44 points. There's always more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Allie Dramoff.
sleeves and put on your gloves, because the work is just beginning.
Monday warrior, me stride. Today's Tom Sawyer, me stride.
Right, it's time to turn the conversation to taking back America. From the crusaders who have drained our treasury, created needless wars, and expect the working people to pay for their billionaires' games, it's time for the Bruce Birch Radio Program. Brought to you by the West Virginia Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. They are building the American dream each and every day. You can get in on the program by dialing in to 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. And now, your host, Bruce Birch.
You're live. This is Bruce Birch. Welcome to the Bruce Birch Radio Program, the premiere edition of the Bruce Birch Radio Program. Man, is it great to be with you today. I'm coming to you live from the Taking Back America Conference at the Washington Hilton in Washington, D.C., and I just got to tell you, this has been an amazing day today. Just the people who have been around, as a matter of fact, sitting right behind me a minute ago was Senator Gary Hart, and we may get him on here in a few minutes. It looks like that may be a possibility. As Guy mentioned a little while ago, there was a group of folks who walked by with these huge oversized heads, and it was the Bush Chain Gang. The Bush Chain Gang. You can go check that out by going to bushchaingang.org. And as I'm sitting here, there's just a whole lot of folks milling about and lots of stuff going on around me. Not the least of which is that we'll have several interviews up shortly. We're going to have on the radio program with me here in a little while, John Jarva, and John is the author of a book called 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Fight the Right, and so we're going to have him on shortly. Later on in the program, we're going to have Cliff Schechter, who is on Guy's radio program here earlier, who is a Democratic strategist. We'll also have Biko Baker, who is a nationally recognized hip-hop organizer and writer. And we'll have an Iraq vet on. Also, we'll have Clint Curtis, as you heard earlier tonight. We will have Clint Curtis on a little bit later on in the program. To talk about some, you know, he's actually running for Congress down in Florida, which is a fantastic thing. I think we need more of these whistleblowers in D.C., not outside of D.C. We need them in D.C. So, speaking as an outsider, of course. But before we get too far into the program, we do have with us on the sitting here next to me is a gentleman by the name of John Jarva, and John is the author of the book 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Fight the Right. John, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine.
I'm doing great. Let's see if we can bring this.
Myself. I'm
there
not
we go.
Sure.
Sorry about that. But apparently somebody turned the mic off while I wasn't looking. You know, that always happens, things like that. Little gremlins running around. You know, must have been a conservative, right? 50 simple things, you can do to fight the right. Website address for the book.
50simplethings.com.
Is it the word 50 or the number 50?
Oh, the number 50. Actually, both will get you there, but we prefer the numeral 50. 50simplethings.com.
Okay. 50simplethings.com. Well, tell me about what sort of gave you the impetus to write the book.
Well, you know, back in 1990, I did a book called 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Save the Earth, which was a number one bestseller. It sold millions of copies and was pretty successful. But I stopped doing books like that for about 15 years. After the presidential election, I woke up the next morning, you know, the morning after, just like a lot of other Americans, and went, oh, my God, what have we done?
Yeah.
And I realized, you know, there was a real chance that my children could grow up in a world that was run by the radical right. And, you know, that's just unacceptable.
Absolutely.
So I decided to do something, and I checked the blogs and the magazines and books, and I found that nobody really was having the conversation about what an average American could do to make a difference in fighting the radical right. And so I decided, since I couldn't find it anywhere else, you know, that I was going to do it, you know, for the other people who were looking for the same thing.
Would you call this progressive activism for dummies, or?
You could do that. No one has yet, but that makes sense.
Okay, well, there's a couple things in the book that really sort of caught my attention. One of them was take back the language. One of the chapters in the book, take back the language, and this deals with framing. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it's not just framing. Framing is a thing on its own. You know, George Lakoff has made that very popular. Take back the language is about is that there are words that you know, words have very specific meaning. And as Lakoff has said to me, you know, when you take the meaning of the words and you change it, then you lose your ability to communicate ideas. And, you know, a word like liberal, we all know that liberal has been demonized to the point where it no longer has meaning. I mean, and liberal is a very proud tradition in American politics. You know, the liberals or progressives have given us everything from direct democracy in senatorial elections, consumer protections, civil rights, the original national parks, the original consumer protection legislation, and so forth. This is very proactive, very positive stuff, the stuff we cherish about America. So when they talk about liberals, and they debase the term liberals, and we allow them to do that, what we lose is an ability to stand up proudly for what we believe. And instead, people think that liberal means wimp. It's the opposite should be true, and it is historically true. Now, what else? You know, words like secular or public. The word public used to mean something you were proud of, a public education. You're working for the public. But the right has demonized the term public, so now it's and undermined it, so now it means something negative. You know, private is good, public is bad. Well, we need to take that back, and okay. we need to be vigilant about that and insist that our meaning is what we mean. We have to know what we mean. We have to insist on it, and when they try to take it back from us or try to debase it, we need to insist. It's a funny thing. You don't think of it as a line in the sand or a place to fight, but it really is important.
Give me some examples of how of some terminology that we can use, or when you say take back the language, how do we take that back? I mean, you know, they've demonized some of this language. You know, does that mean we create new terminology for the same thing, or do we try to just say, you know what, no, that is absolutely not acceptable. We're liberals and we're damn proud of it.
Well, that's right. You know, the first thing you do is define your own words. Okay, mm-hmm. And some words are essential to any political discussion. And, you know, and I've said some of those words, secular, public, freedom, justice, patriotism. Those words are our words. And you, in a conversation, you have to decide what it means to you, and you have to insist on it.
Yes.
And when you find them sort of twisting it, and, you know, you say, no, that's not it. That's not what I mean. Now, that's one way to do it. Another way is to really, you know, replace anything that they're using with your own definition.
Okay.
They say freedom means X, Y, Z. You say, no, to me, freedom means something else.
Civil liberties,
yes. Yeah, and you can make it personal. You can say, this is what I believe. Or, you know, you can say, well, maybe to you, freedom is so-and-so, but to me, freedom is something else. And at that point, you know, it's very difficult for them to take it any further.
Sure.
You need to be aware of it, too. And when you hear people using things like death tax, you know, they may not realize that they're using just the Republican messaging. And they need to challenge them. You know, another thing is, most of these guys, when they use these words, haven't really thought them out. They're just repeating what essentially is a Republican messaging system.
Sure.
And when you challenge them and say, well, what do you mean by that? Are you saying that all liberals are what XYZ? are you saying that I'm so-and-so? They'll generally back off because they haven't thought it through. And finally, this is an important thing. You can take the initiative and turn the tables on them. You know,
okay.
if they, conservatives, you know, you call Bush and his supporters conservatives. What are they conserving? Yeah, conservative. What are they conserving? you know, they're spendthrifts. They're not conservatives. You know, and that sort of thing. You just take the language back. So there are lots of ways that you can do it.
Okay. And this is essentially, from what I'm gathering, this is more of a sort of a strategy that you can use one-on-one with people that you're talking with. Out in your everyday life, you know, if you have a friend who is, you know, I personally have a friend, you know, yes, I'll admit to this. I have a conservative who's a very good friend of mine, and he and I decided a long time ago to not talk about politics. But the interesting thing, just because we wanted to preserve the friendship, you know.
Of course, yeah, that seems perfectly clear.
But every now and then, the politics creeps into the conversation. And, you know, I will say something that, and then follow it up with, this is a progressive value. And he'll go, oh, no, it's not. That's just a value. And And you know, so we argue about that a lot. But one of the other things that I noticed in your book, or one of the other topics that really sort of caught my eye, was reclaim the Bible.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, you know, it's very similar in a way, the idea that they've hijacked something. In the case of words, you know, it's the meaning of the language. In the case of the Bible, they've somehow managed to convince a vast number of Americans that in order to believe in the Scripture, you have to be a right-winger. That somehow the Bible is equivalent to right-wing philosophy. And nothing could be further from the truth. But certainly, at the very least, Bible scholars will tell you that there are things in it that are liberal values and conservative values. And certainly, many will tell you that the liberal values or progressive values are the basis for what Jesus was saying.
Sure.
And it's really important that we stand up to that. That when they start to take it back, you say, wait a minute. According to whom does the Bible mean this or that? You know, somewhere in the book, I give a URL that's connected to an article that Jerry Falwell wrote called God is Pro-War. Now, how you can be...
Sure, Jerry Falwell said God is pro-war, huh?
Yeah, he wrote an article, and there's a URL in here that's connected to that. And you know, the very idea is so preposterous to me, I can't even imagine how he gets there. The important thing is that he gets there, and he's like a used car salesman who sells an idea to the point where people will buy it. And
right.
It's up to us to stand up to that and to say, no, wait a minute. I don't agree with that. You know, if you're a Christian, you say, no, I'm a Christian, and I don't agree with that. If you believe in something else, you say, no, I believe in God, or I believe in whatever I believe in, and that is not true for me.
How, you know, part of that has to be, though, we have to see, or maybe, well, there's a couple things. The first is that, as I mentioned on my program before, those of you who have listened to this, you know, one of the struggles that I've had has been with this whole idea that that the right wing has a hold or a lock on religion and a lock on religious thought. But the problem is that the media will go out and seek out a handful of these religious extremists, Osama bin Robertson,
yeah,
or whoever, you know, Pat Robertson or Jerry Falwell, or what's the other one, James Dobson. We love James Dobson.
Oh, man.
You know, and these are the guys who end up being the spokespeople, if you will, for the Christian religion, and they do not represent the majority of the Christian religion. They just don't.
Yeah, well, they don't numerically, but you know what drives me crazy is when Pat Robertson or one of those guys says, what people of faith want is, and he goes off and says his own philosophy. Now, if you're a progressive and you're a person of faith,
yeah,
you know damn well that he hasn't got a clue what you want. And yet somehow he's managed to convince the media that he speaks for you.
Sure.
And the only way that the media is going to know that he doesn't speak for you is if you stand up and say,
you don't speak for me.
You don't
right.
speak for me. That's right. Right. You know, Pat Robertson or Jerry Falwell or Dobson or any of those guys, or Tony Perkins, don't speak for me. That's what you have to say. And you have to encourage other progressives to speak up that way, too. People who are in a position of authority, maybe a minister who's a progressive. Get
sure.
them to stand up. Get them to go attend community functions and stand up and say what they believe. You know, speak progressively.
Well, I think that's absolutely what we need to do. You know, not only that, but, you know, the other part of this is taking back the churches that you also mentioned in the book.
Well, that's part of the same thing. You know, if you're a member of a congregation, you know, and you're a progressive, you want to have a presence in that congregation. And if you're a part of a progressive congregation, then you want that congregation to have a presence in the community of churches. So that you or synagogues or whatever, you know, houses of worship, so that there's never any chance that the people who want to take it over can actually take it over. And that means, you know, there was a guy in Montana, I think it was, who actually lost his congregation because he was outspoken about the war. And he wrote an article and he said, you know, if you attend church, bring that car that has the carry bumper sticker on it. You know, let people see that in the parking lot.
Sure.
You know, and attend the different Bible study classes and speak up. You know, and if there's an interpretation that's totally right wing, stand up and say, no, I don't agree with that. You know,
right.
That's not the way I interpret the Bible. Because remember, the Bible is always being interpreted. Anybody, if it's one of the big secrets, as a friend of mine says about for Falwell or Robertson or any of those guys, is everything they say is an interpretation.
Absolutely.
And that means
yep.
your interpretation is just as good as theirs. You know, and in 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Fight the Right, we point out that the little things you do, every time you do them, whether it's in church, whether it's in your home, whether it's out in the community, it has a big impact, and impacts you don't even know what they might be.
And I think, you know, the other part of that, too, is that it's just a damn shame. You know, right now the Southern Baptist Convention is occurring in my hometown of Greensboro, North Carolina. And, you know, I think that the biggest shame of that is that they have allowed folks like Jerry Falwell, et cetera, to assume the mantle of leadership within those organizations, which have driven, I mean, you know, a lot of the Baptist down through time, some of them have been very progressive, not all, but some have been very progressive, and those sects, those part of the churches have been driven or basically, you know, stomped on in favor of this hate-filled, you know, I don't want to say it's hate-filled, but this negative, this bigoted sort of version of Christianity.
You know, one of the problems that people of faith have in the left is they feel that they're not welcome. Mm-hmm. I think I should bring that up. And there are people who are the secular left need to remember that the social gospel movement is the basis for a lot of progressive thinking. You know, that people of faith have, all the way through Martin Luther King,
sure.
have used religion to invoke the concern for other human beings that is the hallmark of progressive thinking. So, yeah, that guy Richard Land sort of took over the Baptist, and this is back to your question here, but the Baptist, and it is too bad. It has splintered the group. The right-wing Baptist group is I think, a lot stronger than the left, but they're there. The left is there. The religious left is a critically important part of the progressive movement.
Well, I think it's extremely important that we need to when we're talking about taking back the conversation, that we bring that into it, because a lot of the conversation that we have is about values, you know, and where do values, a lot of moral values, the root of those moral values lies in matters of faith. And, you know, so it's you know, if you know, my values are about equality, my values are about, you know, creating a new kind of society. And if we can do that, you know, that's based in faith.
Well, in the book, 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Fight the Right, one of the things, the first section is called Basic Training. And we have ground rules, four ground rules. And the very first ground rule is, number one, values come first. Don't forget what you're fighting for. And it says, if I may read a little bit of it.
Sure, please do.
It says, the focus of this book is issues in action. But keep in mind that values are the core of the fight against the radical right. To fight effectively, you have to know what you believe in. What matters to you on the deepest level? This is what we're talking about, that values. For example, do you believe in equal opportunity? Do you believe everyone deserves health care? Do you believe in the right to privacy? How about protecting the environment? If you think yes to that, then you've got progressive values. And, you know, that's what you're fighting for. That's what we're fighting for here. And if you express it through religion, fine. If you can express it through some other way, that's fine. And, you know, values are traditional. Progressive values are traditional American values.
Absolutely.
And,
absolutely.
You know, I said, never mind the right-wing propaganda about this thing. You know, just think about it. We believe in freedom of speech. We believe in freedom of religion, civil rights, strong public education, separation of church and state, conservation. Think about that. And what has the other side given us? You know, think about it. You know, the unilateral war, cronyism, fiscal irresponsibility, a polarized society.
And a moron for president.
Yeah. You know, let me give you a couple of really simple things that people can do.
Sure, sure.
If you got no other time but to go into the library, go in there and take out a progressive magazine and put it on the table. Leave it open if you want. The reason for that is that librarians judge pretty much how popular a magazine is by how many times they have to reshelve it, because, you know, the new magazines don't circulate. So if they are constantly putting back the Nation magazine or Mother Jones or one of those magazines, then they're feeling that people are reading them.
Sure.
And that supports the progressive infrastructure.
Whenever you go to the library, just take the magazine out of the rack and leave it laying somewhere.
That's right.
Right.
That's okay. Right. And that's actually doing something positive for the magazines, because then the librarians will re-subscribe to them. Now, if there's no progressive magazine in your library, join with some friends and, you know, come up with the $30 to go get a subscription and get it into the library. You got to check with the librarian first, but if you do that, what's happening? Well, take a magazine like Washington Monthly, mm-hmm. which is a great magazine. They only have 23,000 subscribers. So if you can get one subscription, you're adding to their subscription base considerably.
Sure.
If 1,000 people do it, you're adding 4% to their subscription base.
And that's a great idea.
Yeah, that's really, but it's simple. You want to? Here's another important thing. We need to take back the symbols of American patriotism, right? And because you know, if you see a car driving around, it's got an American flag on it, you just automatically assume, it's a right wing guy driving the car. So suppose now we change that, and suppose you put a bumper sticker on your car with a positive progressive message, something like "My family values clean air and clean water," and right next to it you put a flag decal. Right now, what you're doing is subliminally saying to everyone who sees it that progressive values are American values. Now, you figure a bumper sticker is not a small thing. 100,000 people see it every year on your car. Now, if 1,000 people do it, you're hitting 5 million people with that message.
I just pulled out my little stash of bumper stickers. I have about 300 here.
Yeah, but it's important to include a patriotic symbol with it. You need to put an American flag in there. And now one of the 50 things is practice random acts of patriotism.
Okay.
Okay? Practice random acts of patriotism. It might be July 4th is coming up. Get your organization, your progressive organization, to have a float in the 4th of July parade. That's a random act of patriotism. Even singing the national anthem and, visibly and really, internalizing the meaning of that at a sporting event, that's a random act, and everyone's got their little stories about what they can do. Learn, read the Constitution, read the Declaration of Independence. Internalize that. So it's like exercise. The more you do that, the more you understand that you're a patriot. The more you communicate to people that what you believe and what you're saying comes from a source of patriotism, and that's an important thing to communicate.
Absolutely. One more thing, there was one of the chapters in the book was titled Social Dash-ism.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Well, being social, your interaction, creating community with people is a part of politics, especially progressive politics, because progressivism is about creating a big container for everyone to be part of, pluralism. And the more you interact with people, the more you reinforce your own beliefs and theirs, and the more creative energy comes out of it. There's an outfit called Drinking Liberally, which I highly recommend if you drink. And their chapters, there's like 150 chapters around the country.
He's actually talking about an organization, not an act, okay, folks? It's an organization.
Right. It's a group, and their URL is in the book, and you can get a hold of them and find out where their chapters are, or start a chapter. You get together, but a book group, a knitting group, any kind of group where you get together with people and share that common interest, it strengthens the bonds between you and makes the progressive movement stronger because of that.
Okay. All right. Real quickly, the way that people can get a hold of your book or get a hold of you any other final thoughts you would like to share?
Well, 50 simple things you can do to fight the right you can read sample chapters of it on 50simplethings.com, and that is the numeral 50. You can certainly purchase it at any local bookstore or online at Amazon or Powell's or Barnes & Noble. And I think people will find it an easy read and also an inspiring one.
John Jovna, thank you so much for joining me today on the Birch Radio program. I certainly hope that we will run into each other again somewhere down the road, but not the least of which, I'd like to have you back on for an interview again.
I'll be glad to do it, Bruce. Thanks.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot
All
for
right.
joining us.
All right.
And you're listening to the Bruce Birch Radio Program. My name is Bruce Birch. I'm your host. If you'd like to get in on the radio program, you can call 1-877-443-2366. That's 1-877, the number 4, head on. You can also send me an email, if you're so inclined, to bruce@brucebirch.com. That's bruce@brucebirch.com. You can also visit my new website, brucebirch.com. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and I will be right back after these short messages.
Back home again. Been a little trouble. They all kind of look. The Head On Radio Network is brought to you every night by the Carpenters and Millwrights. The Mid-Atlantic Regional Council of Carpenters is a portion of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America, or more commonly called the Carpenters Union. The millwrights are a very specialized craft that perform their work with highly sensitive equipment and perform much of their work on machinery like turbines, laser alignment, and other highly specialized tools. We would like to thank the Carpenters and Millwrights for their support, because freedom of speech is free. And it's brought to you by the Carpenters and Millwrights, working hard every day to provide a brighter future. Thank you from the Head On Radio Network.
When Bruce and I filled in for Bob Kincaid, we didn't know what to expect, but we sure didn't expect a call from the Decider.
I told Walmart to sell the Easter egg dye kits, you know, the ones with the resurrection egg. We decided in Camp David that we were going to support Walmart and go with what the Lord told them and buy some of them resurrection egg kits. And, you know, I found the resurrection egg. God spoke to me through that egg. And God told me that I am the fourth member of the Holy Trinity. We're calling it the Holy Quadraphonic. So now I'm the fourth voice of the Holy Trinity. So now I've got four voices in my head. I have the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost and the Decider. I'm the Decider. I get to decide.
Don't miss Head On with Bob Kincaid, weekdays 7 to 10 p.m. and Fourth Estate Radio with John Fox and Bruce Birch, Saturdays 10 p.m. Eastern Time on the Head On Radio Network.
This is Bruce Birch, and I'd like to invite you to join me for a brand new show here on the Horn, the Bruce Birch Radio Program. Tune in Monday through Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network. Bruce, I'm your host. If you want to get in on the show, you can do that by dialing 1-877-443-2366. That's 1-877, the number 4, Head On. And joining me right now is Cliff Schechter, who was on Guy James' show earlier today. But we're going to talk about a different topic. And, well, I guess, did you guys talk about Homeland Security?
No, I don't believe we touched on that one.
We're going to touch on Homeland Insecurity today.
That's more accurate, yes.
And Cliff is, these are all kinds of neat stuff. Cliff is a veteran campaign strategist, political commentator. He writes a monthly column distributed by Knight Ritter and was a guest columnist for the UPI from 2002 to 2004. His work has been featured in a variety of publications, including the Miami Herald, the American Prospect, the Atlanta JC, Journal Constitution, the Fordham Urban Law Journal, the Sacramento Bee, and Salon.com. He blogs for the Gadflyer and a weekly satirical column each Friday. I write a weekly satirical column each Friday called Cliff's Corner on America Blog.
That's correct.
So, Cliff, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, man. Better than I deserve. Better than I deserve.
Absolutely.
But let's talk about homeland insecurity, if you will. I'm holding a piece in front of me that it's about these DHS employees who seem to have a taste for, shall we say, San Quentin quail?
Yes, there seem to be many in the community of DHS employees who seem to like to troll the internet for that extra special catch that I think most of us would be very upset about. It's not so much just insecurity as it's downright well, it's prowling. Frankly, it's rather disgusting.
Have these guys? I mean, you know, okay. So we have Brian Doyle, 55, arrested for trying to solicit sex from a 14-year-old who was really an undercover cop through the internets.
The internets, yes.
Which one? Well.
Well, as Bush would say,
he works for
the internet.
Since he works for DHS, I'm sure he has access to them all, especially the ones that we don't even know about.
Exactly.
Have these guys been using like the whole wiretapping or any of the undercover illegal ways to go about finding these girls, or what are they doing exactly?
I haven't seen that in any of the stories, but I've got to tell you, it's kind of scary if you think about it, that they, you know, we're told we're supposed to distrust these people who are illegally listening to our conversations and who are, you know, looking at our information, and you find a bunch of these guys who are high up at DHS are actually using their computers to try and pick up young girls. And it's worse than that. I mean, not only are they doing that, this guy Doyle actually told the girl who he was. So imagine if this is somebody, anybody, a criminal or somebody faking that they're a young girl and they're like, somebody couldn't pull that off, you know.
I mean, how stupid is that? I mean, I'm not that I'm saying that, you know, they should be smarter about this because it's obviously a terrible crime, but... And these are folks who were in the upper echelon.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one guy was, you know, he got busted down in Florida, actually. It was a guy who was the head of Project, was it Project Predator? I think you've got it right there. It was the one that actually was supposed to prevent those who would go after and try and prowl on young girls. He was in charge of that actual program, and he got caught for touching himself in a very fast way. In a mall in Florida.
rapid way. For 10 minutes.
Rapid self-flagellation.
He stood there for 10 minutes.
You know, it's...
What do you say to that?
What do you say to a man that would walk up to somebody in a mall and, you know, take their pants down and do something like that to begin with? But when these people are working for DHS, when they're working for the specific programs that are supposed to protect our children, protect our country... I don't know what it is about the Bush administration, but it seems to me that you literally have to commit some sort of a criminal act to be a part of them. I mean, there's a serious ones. There's the ones where you get to be a traitor and out undercover agents and do things like that. But then there's just the ones like this and the ones like the guy Claude Allen that got arrested for trying to take things back into Target that he hadn't purchased and get the money for them. I mean, you know, it's like...
And he was making $100,000 a year.
Yeah. And, you know, he was a supposed, you know, very religious man, conservative, all that, all this great stuff that one's supposed to be. I don't know what it is with these guys. It's almost like you have to be shot in the arm with some sort of a pheromone that causes you to become a criminal when you join the Bush administration.
And all crazy, weird stuff aside, you know, I think what's most troubling is that these are the very people who are going to be making decisions about where the money goes for Homeland Security. And, you know, I think the one thing one of the things that I've been focusing on as far as on this radio program as much as possible is the connection between some of the local surveillance efforts by local police and Homeland Security and, you know, how those two entities are working together to create a larger system of surveillance and of domestic spying within the U.S. And now these guys, the ones who are out there trying to pick up 10-year-old girls, are the ones who are in charge of that.
Right. I mean, it's scary in many ways. I mean, you asked where they're going to choose to put the money. We know they're at least not going to put the money into catching computer prowlers because it's not really in their self-interest now, is it?
No, it's not in their self-interest to catch themselves, is it?
Wouldn't want to get ensnared in that net.
This guy, this Figueroa guy, he was in charge. It blows my mind. It totally blows my mind. He was in charge of the program to bust child predators. And what is he? What is he but a child predator? opposite world again with the Bush administration.
I mean, you know, this aspect is one of just the many. I mean, you know, a lot of their stuff we've talked about in the past, people have ad nauseum from the ports and, you know, not inspecting cargo that comes in. Still the fact that I think, what was it, somebody did a test where the government did a test and 22 or 23 out of 23 people that wanted to get through with some sort of an explosive device were able to do so. We're not saying, I mean, that's the crime of it, and Democrats have failed in that way not to to bring these issues up and to let the Republicans prance around on Homeland Security and act like they've made us safer. What a joke. I mean, we are so much, you know, if anything, we're just as unsafe. I'd say more likely we are less safe. They were told, you know, ahead of time that a huge storm was going to blow up a city, and they decided to, you know, roast marshmallows and go to sleep. So, I mean, what does that tell you about everything? They're cutting funding now from the top places that we expect to get attacked, but they're jacking it up, you know, the funding for places like Topeka. So, you know,
which makes me wonder, in turn, is that about a larger purpose? I mean, I don't want to get off in any conspiracy theories about any of this stuff, mainly because there's plenty of reality that needs to be questioned, but
right.
Conspiracy realities that need to be questioned. But, you know, when you look at that money distribution and you look at the fact that Washington and New York both were cut this time around, and yet places like Topeka, Kansas, or my hometown of Greensboro, North Carolina, you know, a little small, 250,000 people there, when you look at that, it makes you wonder exactly what is going on. Is there a credible threat to Topeka, Kansas that we're not aware of? Is that
not one?
What is there anyway?
Not one that's external that I know about.
Yes, another Timothy McVeigh, perhaps.
Yeah, there may be one of those. The only thing I can guess is that this is what it is with them in every single other case, which is it's corruption and politics as usual, which is where can they buy votes? You know, that Medicare bill, even though it backfired because shockingly the elderly were able to figure out that it was a dog, you know, and that it made no sense. But that Medicare bill was just about buying off the elderly. There are other cases they're buying off, quote unquote, suburban moms with no child left behind. They only pass things like that when there's a benefit to them politically. And
sure.
I think here it's the same thing as you see with the pork, with the bridge to nowhere and all those other ridiculous spending items they have in there. I think that Homeland Security, instead of actually being the money where we say we need to put this where it protects us, they put it where they can get the most votes from and the most power and the contributions. And it blows your mind. It really does.
So the blue states, they're basically going to cede the blue states to the terrorists.
Yes, it seems that's exactly it. If you're a blue state, you're completely ceded.
If you're, you know, unless you vote for us.
Exactly. If you're a swing state, you maybe got a chance.
Yeah, you got a chance, but...
red state, you got so much money, you're just flowing in it.
You guys can buy grenade launchers in the red states. In the blue states, slingshots.
Right. In the red states, they're going to give you...
I was going to say, let us not ever forget David and Goliath.
That's true. I was going to say, you know, they will give you enough money in the red states that you can go out and get a state-of-the-art computer to then go try and meet a young girl.
That's what it's for. It's to re-up the police department. Now let me ask you this. This is turning into a comedy show.
I'm sorry.
It's okay, Cliff. It's great. Laugh. If we can't laugh, what are we going to do, right?
That's right. I choose to live life.
I'm tired of crying, man. You know,
I know.
It's time to get
too
real.
Much of that.
That's exactly right. Let me ask you this. The Homeland Security money that has been donated now, this is for local infrastructure or the granting that's going on from the Homeland Security Department?
You're talking about the different money that they're handing out?
Sure.
Yeah, it's for a whole number of protective measures, for infrastructure measures. I think the money goes to pay off first responders and others like that. I think it goes to harden what they consider soft targets that, you know. I mean, you here in Washington, for example, it took I don't know how long for them to just get blast-proof, garbage cans in the metro, for example. I mean, I'm sure a lot of those types of things where the money is going to. No?
What's the you said that perhaps the Bush administration has made us more prone or more susceptible to a terrorist attack? In what ways are we weaker than we were?
Well, I mean, certainly. the easiest one to talk about is Iraq. I mean, we are so stretched thin right now. Our troops are at a breaking point. I mean, look, all troops are over there. We didn't have the sufficient resources to send in the National Guard and take care of Louisiana when we were hit by that hurricane, so that weakens us. What happens when there's an attack and we don't have the sufficient National Guardsmen, because these guys that thought they were going to get a cheaper college education have all been sent over to Iraq? To a war where we were told that we were fighting terrorists when now there was a very bad dictator there, who, by the way, the Reagan and Bush people helped put in power, but that's a whole other story. There was a dictator there who's a murderer, and I never say a nice thing about Saddam Hussein, and, you know, only the worst things can happen to him and make me happy. The point is, that wasn't, after 9/11, where we should have been going. We should have been taking care of protecting our country and fortifying and going after the people that were who were dangerous. But, you know, there are many ways. I mean, Iraq is a mess now, so you've got more guys coming in there, jihadists. Afghanistan is unstable. You've got the highest, the poppy plants, you know, they're growing the poppy plant at its highest level again, so we can expect all sorts of new shipments of heroin to come in. Additionally, you've got terrorists, you know, who are taking over parts of Afghanistan again. We split up in some of these networks of jihadists who are getting training in Iraq and then are going and blowing up other places. Look what almost happened in Canada. I'm not saying those guys are from Iraq. I'm just saying, you know, we did stop that one. I'll give that to them. But, you know, maybe there's a next one and other guys doing things. Maybe we stop what happened in England, or maybe we stop what happened in Madrid or Istanbul or, you know, a million other places. If we're out there and we're fighting the right guys,
well,
putting our resources into Iraq.
I thought we were going to be fighting them there so we wouldn't fight them here.
Of course, because it's always an either-or kind of thing.
Yeah, it's never, you know, gray areas like guys in Canada. And,
right.
you know, I got to tell you.
A terrorist,
what were they pissed off about?
In Canada?
Did they have to wait in line too long to see the doctor? I mean, what was that, you know, maybe...
Get the gravy fries.
Oh,
know?
That's... okay, I'm sorry, Cliff. We got no. Cliff Schechter on the radio program this afternoon. We're going to take a quick break, Cliff, and come back. But this is Bruce Birch. You're more than welcome to call in, 1-877-443-2366, or you can send me an email to bruce@brucebirch.com. Always at brucebirch.com. All right, we'll be right back. To the Taking Back America conference.
The police in New York City chased a boy right through the park. In the face of mistaken identity, they put a bullet through his heart.
What's it like?
What's it like?
It's lonely.
It's really lonely.
I miss my brother.
I miss my brother.
I'm surrounded by other people, but it's not the same.
I've got other people around me, but it's not the same.
It's pretty scary, but I don't let it rattle me.
It's scary around here, but I don't let it rattle me.
You always have to watch your back.
There's no one to watch my back.
I spend my whole day worried who's out to get me.
I'm always wondering who's out to get me.
But I can take care of myself.
But I can take care of myself.
No matter what, I'll keep my head up.
No matter what, I'll keep my head up.
It's not like I have a choice.
It's not like I have a choice.
This'll all be over in 5 years, 3 months, and 17 days.
This'll all be over in 5 years, 3 months, and 17 days.
Go to jail for a gun crime and your family serves a sentence with you. Something to think about before committing a gun crime. Gun crimes hit home. This message brought to you by Project Safe Neighborhoods and the Ad Council.
This is Lee Hamilton
and Ron Saracen of the U.S. Capitol Historical Society.
Our Capitol has hosted some of the great debates of our history,
and we're both proud to have served here.
But there is no guarantee that representative democracy will simply continue on.
We all need to ask ourselves whether we're doing our part as citizens,
staying informed, engaging elected officials, and being active in our communities.
It's our history,
and it's also our future.
Get involved.
We often hear claims Muslims don't condemn terrorism,
and that Islam condones violence.
As Muslims, we want to state clearly
that those who commit acts of terror in the name of Islam are betraying the teachings of the Quran and the Prophet Muhammad.
We reject anyone of any faith who commits such brutal acts
and will not allow our faith to be hijacked by criminals.
Islam is not about hatred and violence. It's about peace and justice.
Hi, my name is Aaron, and I'm a survivor of mannequinism. Mannequinism is basically when you turn into a hard plastic shell. This is from not being politically active. For me, it started when I didn't register to vote, and then I stopped volunteering, and before I knew it, I wasn't doing anything. And that's when I found the first sign. A small, discolored hard patch of plastic on my right shoulder. I thought it would go away on its own, but it didn't. It kept spreading. And when I could no longer conceal it with a t-shirt, I knew I had to see the doctor. He said I had this early stage of mannequinism and that my only hope was to get involved, even if it was something simple. So I began reading the newspaper and instantly got feeling back in my arm. I guess you could say I'm living proof you can fight mannequinism.
Protect yourself from mannequinism. Log on to fightmannequinism.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
That's right. Hey, this is Bruce Birch. You're back on the Bruce Birch radio program. And sitting with me to my left is my good friend now, Cliff Schechter. Cliff,
we're buddies.
We're buddies now. You know, it's great. We're having a good time here. There's just all kinds of neat stuff going on, people running back and forth. And, it's just a fantastic conference. Have you been to any have you been to any sessions yet?
Yeah, absolutely. A bunch of the – one of the ones that was just on a new media strategy in terms of progressive media, which is what you are. So that's a good thing.
We're not only progressive media, we're on the progressive edge of progressive media.
You are at the edge.
We're so far. Okay, you know. How far on the edge are you? don't blow too hard.
So that one's a good one because there are some folks who are involved in radio as well as other progressive ventures, you know, blogging online and, you know, other things that, you know, that, of how the left is trying to build an infrastructure to match, not even match, let's face it, just something to even come close to the infrastructure built up by the right since the 1960s, 1970s, with big corporations putting millions of dollars into think tanks and media outlets and, you know, and all the other stuff they do.
Let's talk a little bit about strategy, Cliff, because
sure.
I think, you know, one of the things, there's two things that I see that are very, that are pervasive on the left, you know, middle to the left side of the spectrum politically. The first thing is the lack of, or seemingly perceived lack of strategy on the left. The second thing is that there doesn't seem to be any real effort to create a strategy.
Well, you know, I think that's a problem, and I think we saw that in that recent race in San Diego, where, you know, let's face it, look, it was a very Republican district. But, you know, you have Randy Duke Cunningham, who likes to take $200,000 French toilets or whatever it was he got in the gift, in the nice gift bag from his friend.
Duke.
Yeah, exactly. you'd think we would have had a great shot there. And from what I hear in the race, and I tried to follow as closely as I could from here, but the candidate on the Democratic side talked more about the culture of corruption. And I think that's an important part of what we're talking about here, because there is a culture of corruption, and it very much, about 98% revolves around Republicans here in Washington. But I think also you need to give people, you need to talk about your ideas on issues. And, you know, it's funny, we were talking about Homeland Security before.
Yeah.
Because in past elections, I know I worked on a race in 2002, and the advice was just don't talk about it. Talk about Social Security, Medicare, and these are important issues. Let's not get that wrong. But, you know, people need to hear Democratic ideas on security because, frankly, you know, Democratic ideas on security are a hell of a lot better than the Republican ones. Republicans have failed. I mean, Democrats are the ones, you know, who successfully won world wars and crafted, you know, things from the Marshall Plan to NATO. And you know, we have a history, and somehow that's been forgotten. You know, particularly with Homeland Security now and Iraq and the whole situation, I mean, the strategy needs to be that people need to come out and say, you know, strongly, this is the wrong war, this is not helping, this is hurting, and we need to have an exit strategy now. I mean, it doesn't mean we take the troops out tomorrow, but we need to have a strategy now to get out of there as soon as we can before our forces are broken. I think that is a key component. I think economic populism is a key component. I mean, what is it when you see some of the Democrats, a few Democrats from some of the poorest districts voting for this ridiculous estate tax repeal?
You know, I don't understand it. I mean, you know, the other part of that is that these people, and you know, on our radio network, we talk about this a lot because the people who are the hosts on this network are, you know, are working stiffs or have been working stiffs. We're not celebrities telling the rest of the world how to live. We are people who have walked a mile in those shoes. And to watch people vote directly against their own best interest is just a baffling thing to me. It's just completely, I don't understand it.
I don't either. And they needed to, you know, at least I will say on the estate tax, it failed this time because enough Democrats took a line in the sand. They need to come out. I wish they'd done it on that crappy bankruptcy bill that was absolutely ridiculous. They need to put a line in the sand and say corporations have gotten too powerful. Look at what happened with Enron. It wasn't just, you know, why did that happen? It's because we've been deregulating all these industries and letting these guys do whatever they want. Enron,
absolutely.
Tyco, go on with all of them. You know, so we need to regulate these industries. We need to stand up for working people and pass programs like, you know, like paid family leave and like a raise in the minimum wage and like, you know, universal health care and programs that working people will benefit from. And I think if you offer people economic advantages from some of these programs, as well as a strong national security strategy that we can explain to people, I think we will win. And a part of that strategy being explaining how we get out of Iraq to make our country stronger. If people will stand up for their principles, we will win.
Well, you know, we were talking about Homeland Security before we went to our break, and one of the things that I've observed has been that the fact that we are in Iraq, killing, I don't want to say we're killing them, but in the last 5 months, 6,000 civilians have gone through the Baghdad morgue.
Wow, yeah.
That's somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 times more than went through the Baghdad morgue when Saddam Hussein was in power. And that's a very sobering fact. And that cannot bode well for, you know, the hundreds or thousands of young jihadists who are, or you know, whatever they are, who are looking at us and saying, you know what, the United States is absolutely not anything that I want to have anything to do with. They want to come to us and just basically blow us up.
Yeah, and I think the scary thing and the sad thing about it is I think some of these people started off on our side. I don't think when we got there they were all anti-American, you know, and they all hated America. I think that is something from, you know, some of our negligence and some of the mistakes that we've made there. You know, not when people lose their electricity and they lose food and they lose all these basic necessities forever and they see their relatives get killed by errant bombs and stuff like that.
Sure.
You know, they come to hate you. And it is a sad thing because I think the soldiers are doing, you know, the best job that one could ask of them. I mean, to be young guys sent off, or I don't think, frankly, often trained for this. You know, they thought they were going to be the National Guard. I think they're doing a heck of a job. I think that I hate to use heck of a job after Brownie. You know, that's all I can think of. But in any case, I think they're doing the best job they can. I think the fact of the matter is history has taught us that occupations fail when the people who are being occupied don't want you there.
Right.
Whether
if you're
it's
not
the British getting kicked out of India or whether it's the French getting kicked out of Algeria, and we know we can go us in Vietnam. When people do not want you there, when they want you there, it's a whole different story. When they don't want you there, we've gone in, even though I was against the war from the beginning, and I think it was a terrible mistake, and we've gone in and initially done everything right and maybe set up the made sure that we protected the electricity grid and done this, and then I had enough troops, protected people, maybe there's a chance we would have won people over. But because these guys ran this thing so horribly, we're past the tipping point. We can't win those people back anymore.
No, we can't. And, you know, I think that there's a whole bevy of questions that sort of surround that, but we're getting up to the top of the hour, and the end of the interview is coming nigh, my friend. Very quickly, how can people get a hold of you, or do you have a website they can come to and see your writings?
Right now, I actually am going to be setting up my own blog soon. Shame that I haven't done that yet so I could promote it on your show, but I guess I'll just have to come back on your show again.
Absolutely.
I write at a very popular blog. It's called America Blog. So it's www.americablog.com. And I write a column every Friday, which is called Cliff's Corner.
Okay.
And it's where I get to be me and not have to, let's say, follow all the conventions that one does. Like, let's say when I write for Knight Rider, I do that, you know, sometimes. In for Cliff's Corner, I can actually use some of those words, some bad words, but I can get passionate. I can be passionate, and I can try to be funny. And so it's a satirical column, the roundup of the GOP follies for the week. So every Friday, if you're on the East Coast, your people that are listening, if they're in North Carolina, anywhere between 4 and 8, that column called Cliff's Corner gets posted at www.americablog.com. Otherwise, there's a place, www.politicstv.com, where we do some web television, and I'm going to be hosting my own show
oh, cool.
starting pretty
excellent,
soon.
Excellent, excellent.
I've done some work with them, and that's going to continue on, and there'll be additional places, and I'll just make sure to, but when my blog gets up and everything gets going, I'll let you know next time I come
on. We'll make sure to get a link on brucebirch.com to go straight to that blog. Cliff, thanks for joining us so much on this program, and certainly hope that the rest of the conference serves you well.
Thank you so much. You've got a great show. I appreciate
okay,
it.
Okay, thank you. And that was Cliff Schechter, who has, you've heard all the things he does. Fantastic guy, wonderful, wonderful guest. We'll have him back on the program again at some point. You're listening to the Bruce Birch Radio Program here on the Head On Radio Network. If you want to get in on the show, you can do that. 1-877-443-2366. Or send me an email, bruce@brucebirch.com. We'll be right back.
This is Quality News Network. The Supreme Court has unanimously ruled that death row inmates scheduled to die from lethal injections can make last-minute claims that the chemicals used are too painful and therefore amount to cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Eighth Amendment. In a separate 5-3 ruling, the justices also made it easier for condemned inmates to challenge their convictions with new evidence, the court saying that a Tennessee death row inmate can use DNA evidence to try and prove his innocence 20 years after being convicted of murder. Forecasters have issued a hurricane warning for much of Florida's Gulf Coast as Alberto, the first tropical storm of the new hurricane season, continues to strengthen. It's expected to make landfall tomorrow. Coast Guard is continuing to search for survivors from the sinking of a 33-foot pleasure boat last night off Florida's southeast coast. The boat was carrying 9 people, including 4 children, all of whom were wearing life jackets. Squalls from Alberto have reduced visibility for the search crews, but it's still unclear whether the sinking was weather-related. The U.S. military reports that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi lived for 52 minutes after a U.S. warplane bombed his hideout near Baghdad on Friday, and that he died of extensive internal injuries consistent with those caused by a bomb blast. President Bush is at Camp David for 2 days of meetings with his top military and civilian war advisors, meetings which will include a video conference with Iraq's commanders. U.S. troop withdrawal is expected to be discussed, especially in the wake of comments yesterday by the top U.S. commander in Baghdad that coalition troops could gradually move out of the country in the coming months. One of the 3 detainees who committed suicide over the weekend at Guantanamo Bay had been cleared for transfer to another country, but it's not clear whether he knew about it. The U.S. military says all 3 men, 2 Saudis and 1 from Yemen, left suicide notes, the contents of which have not been released. The coordinated suicides have sparked renewed calls for the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo to be closed. A new report shows that U.S. spending in Iraq and Afghanistan helped push up global military expenditure last year by 3.5% to $1.12 trillion. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute says the U.S. is responsible for 48% of the world total. The FBI reports that murders, robberies, and aggravated assaults in this country increased last year, spurring an overall rise in violent crime for the first time since 2001. Both critics and proponents of the government's domestic surveillance program were in court today to argue its constitutionality. And an Israeli passenger train carrying 200 people from Tel Aviv to Haifa crashed into a truck at a rail crossing today and derailed, killing at least 5 people and injuring 67. It's 2.5 past the hour.
Most people would rather have a root canal than go to a dealer to buy a car. But you can turn dread into joy when you learn how to play the car buying game. Read the book, Right Car, Right Price, and you'll discover how the game is played and how you can win every time. Whether you're buying a car or a truck, new or used, Right Car, Right Price explains how to find and buy the vehicle best suited to your individual transportation needs. Auto Week called Right Car, Right Price the right stuff. So take the hassle out of car buying. Read Right Car, Right Price, and every time you get into your new car, you'll know you've got a great deal. Go online to rightcarrightprice.com to order your copy today. It only takes an hour to read Right Car, Right Price, and it just costs $10. We even pay the postage. So go to rightcarrightprice.com right now. It'll be one of the best decisions you ever make.
Daimler Chrysler says it's recalling about 111,000 Jeep Grand Cherokees after receiving reports of overheating and fires in heated seats. Facing the loss of tens of thousands of unionized blue-collar auto jobs in coming years, the head of the United Auto Workers Union is calling for a more collaborative approach to the deep-seated problems, including high health care costs that are facing the U.S. industry. Lehman Brothers says its quarterly earnings jumped 47%, driven by sharp gains in revenue from trading and investment banking. Italian fashion group Fendi SRL is suing Walmart in federal court, accusing the world's largest retailer of selling Fendi knockoffs and passing them off as genuine at its Sam's Club stores. U.S. gas prices remain stable over the past 3 weeks. The latest Lundberg survey shows that the average nationwide price for a gallon of self-serve regular is $2.93. That's where it was on May 19th. The insurance industry says it has settled over 90% of its Hurricane Katrina claims, but consumer advocates say insurers settled numerous of those claims for only a fraction of actual damages. Verizon Wireless plans to launch a wireless service today to let parents check on their children's whereabouts and alerts them when they venture out of bounds. And Discover Financial Services is introducing its first credit card for small businesses, aiming to make it easier for owners and their employees to pay their bills. Light sweet crude oil trading at $70.60 a barrel. The Dow Industrials are down 5, NASDAQ is down 20, and the S&P 500 is off by 4 points. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Diana Walter. It's now 5 minutes past the hour.
It's time for another hour of conversation radio on the Head On Radio Network. Where the callers are the experts. You're back with the Bruce Birch Radio Program. With your host, Bruce.
That's right, you're back on the Bruce Birch radio program. This is Bruce, and I'm glad to have you back on with me. I'm at the Taking Back America Conference in Washington, D.C., at the Washington Hilton. And I got to tell you, it's really a fantastic crowd out here today. I was watching some of the folks come by. We had a group of people called the, Bush Chain Gang.org. Who came by, and they gave me a card, and on the card it says, the British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. And this is from the George W. Bush State of the Union Address, 12803, and a very interesting little group of folks. They had these huge, oversized heads. These were the biggest heads I've ever seen in my life. These heads were probably, I don't know, maybe 5 feet. Big, tall, huge heads of Bush caricatures, of course, of Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Condoleezza Rice. And all right. So we just had a wonderful interview with Cliff Schechter, who was we talked about strategy with a little bit, and also homeland insecurity. I was hoping to have Biko Baker at this point, but he hasn't showed up yet, so we're going to go ahead with some other things that we're going to talk about, not the least of which, of course, is, stuff that's going on in the news. You know, your phone calls are welcome. If you want to call in, you can do that by dialing 1-877-443-2366, or, if you like letters instead of numbers, 1-877, the number 4, Head On. We'll get you also into the radio program. A little bit later on in the show, should have Cliff Curtis, who was the whistleblower in Florida, who is actually running for Congress now. He's actually running for Congress now, and I'm looking to see if I can find that. He's running for Congress in, I'm looking for the district, 24th District of Florida. So we need more whistleblowers in D.C., not outside of D.C., as I'm going to tell him a little bit later on. Interesting thing that all these folks from Florida, they've got a storm down there. And it looks like to me that this storm could be pretty bad. More than 20,000 people along Florida's Gulf Coast were ordered to clear out Monday as Alberto, the very first tropical storm of the new hurricane season, unexpectedly picked up steam and threatened to come ashore as a hurricane. All right, what is today's date? Today is the 12th, June the 12th. Hurricane season has been going officially 6 days. Oh, my God. Global warming? Nah, no such thing. Carbon dioxide? It's not death. It's life. Opposite world for these people. Forecasters posted a hurricane. Forecasters posted a hurricane warning for the Gulf Coast and a tropical storm warning from north of Daytona Beach to the Georgia-South Carolina line, saying the storm could hit on Tuesday morning. Governor Jeb Bush signed a declaration of emergency allowing him to call the National Guard and put laws against price gouging in place. What? A Republican putting a law against price gouging in place? This sounds almost unheard of. Bush said, quote, "We're talking about powerful forces of nature. People need to take this very seriously." Okay, Jeb. Whatever you say, buddy. Whatever you say. All right. We're going to actually, I've got an interesting person who is accompanied me on this trip, and we're going to bring her on just because she's been running around and doing all kinds of neat stuff, attending conferences, attending meetings and plenary sessions. And one of the sessions that she had actually attended was the plenary session where Harry Reid spoke. And at lunchtime today, Harry was here running around with about 50 people in tow, including about 5 Secret Servicemen. And so we're going to bring up none other than my the better half of the Bruce Birch radio program, Deborah.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight? Yeah, it's been a pretty cool day. Today has been began with all the murmurs of having Robert Redford present here, which I was very excited about, and it was like one of those situations where you show up 5 minutes after he just left. So I had to make do with doing the plenary session, seeing him from 500 feet away in a big screen, and but exciting nonetheless. And I think what was even more exciting than that was the panel that he was sitting with. And having the president of the United Steel Workers Union as one of the main speakers and receiving the Apollo Award, and the Apollo Award being the award that is being promoted by the Apollo Alliance. And the Apollo Alliance is essentially a alliance of organizations that have come together to address the issue of global warming and environment. And I think it speaks to my ignorance a little bit when I was surprised that the president of the Steelworkers Union actually received the first ever Apollo Award for environmental justice. He was very impassioned and very good, and you know, it made me feel hopeful at a time where you know, the films that are coming out that talk about global warming make you feel a little bit dispirited, and it makes you wonder what kind of a world you're leaving for your children, and knowing that you want to leave it better than you left it behind. It's pretty powerful to see the people that are working towards this issue. So it was exciting to sit there and hear all of the speakers and just be a part of such a wonderful exciting event, really.
Now you also attended the session on new media, progressive media, innovative media. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, they had some pretty cool speakers, including Jay Harris, the publisher of Mother Jones, Alexandra Walker, the executive editor of TomPaine.com, Robert Greenwald, of course, is coming out with a new film on Iraq here shortly. Julie Bergman-Sender, who is with an organization called The Cause. Cenk Uygur, who is, of course, with the Young Turks. And Roberto Lobato, who is with New American Media. And I think that what they were talking about really is coming together as a media consortium. And really, because this is such a new venue where we have so many bloggers out there that are doing wonderful work, so many people that are doing internet radio that perhaps are not as recognized, including us, are not as recognized as we would like to be. But coming together as a media consortium and being able to sell ad space a little bit more effectively, where when you're selling ad space, you're not only selling it on Mother Jones, but you're selling it on blog space and web space and everything intertwined. We also talked about how to further the cause through this media consortium and all being of the same voice, and that there is so much that is being done, but there is so much that is not being done, and that we can't wait for the next smart person to say, okay, that needs to be done and I'll do it. You out there listening are the next person that should be doing whatever it is coming to mind. And as Nike so very well puts it, just do it. And just do it in so many different ways, you know?
Well, you know, and I really regret that you didn't get to see Robert Redford, but you know, he and I had a few words. And
it was
all right, but
I was so sad, y'all. I always got there like 5 minutes too late. It was just too much. You know, Bruce, the other one that I really want to talk about, which it speaks to me being a Latina woman and doing a lot of you know, a lot of the work out there that has to do with undoing racism and racial justice and all of that good stuff. I went to a workshop that was called Building Power, People of Color in the Progressive Movement. And we had people from the progressive majority who were speaking and were talking about their racial justice campaign and really stating the fact that if we are going to be making a change within the progressive movement, we have to have candidates of color out there, and just how sorely lacking we are in candidates of color within the Democratic Party, but within any representation, and just how we need to start organizing in that area. And I was listening to her, to one person in particular, Ms. Lazu, was speaking as to how they were organizing in 8 different states. And I'll have that interview for you guys tomorrow. We're going to go ahead and do a taped interview with her and hopefully put it on the air shortly. I know that Bruce has got so many people lined up within the next couple of days that we're going to actually have to tape some of this stuff, because there's no way that we're going to be able to get it all on the air. So that was kind of my day, just besides walking around and meeting different people and just being very excited about the representation that we have here. 2,000 people registered for the conference itself.
2,000 people trying to take back America.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you, Debbie, for that. We're going to go to a quick break. You are listening to the Bruce Birch radio program. If you want to get in on the show, you can do so. Matter of fact, this may be your only window in the next 10, 15 minutes, because we've got interviews lined up, you know, at least they're tentative. Of course, everything is tentative until it's happened. So if you want to get in on the radio program, you can dial 1-877-443-2366. You can also send me an email to bruce@brucebirch.com. That's bruce@brucebirch.com. We'll be right back.
Thank you. speaking of thievery.
Yes.
Just wanted to let you know that Alistair Cook, okay, last year, right?
Yes.
He died of lung cancer that spread to his bones. He was 95 years old. Apparently, his bones have been or were stolen. Apparently, there's a ring of people out there that steal bones. They steal these bones and they make dental implants. Apparently, now he had cancer all in his bones, right? But the people who stole the bones rewrote the paperwork to make it look like he died of a heart attack. So now there's somebody else walking around out there with his diseased, cancerous bones in their body.
That is freaky.
Yeah, I just thought it was so...
oh my God.
I thought it was so ghoulish.
It just freaks me out. Anyway. Hey, don't forget to join Bruce and I Saturday, 10 p.m. Eastern Time for the next edition of Fourth Estate Radio. Get the streaming details at fourthestateradio.com. That's fourthestateradio.com.
Okay, listen up. If you're sick of hearing lies by right-wing corporate pukes who like to pretend they stand up for the working guy, then head over to the Cup of Joe radio show where the truth will hit you so hard you'll have to wear your hard hat. You can listen to the screaming audio at cupojoe.blogspot.com. That's cupojoe.blogspot.com. Now get back to work.
There's a place on the web you can go where everything is so topical you can apply it liberally. WD40.com. Clyde, Wally, and Dookie are there working hard for you every day. It's a place where you can go to raise your voice and be heard. WD40.com. DUBYAD40.com. So stop on by. The 101st Fighting Keyboardists of Kansas are ready to hear your opinion. There are topics of news, current events, and great humor. So let Clyde, Wally, and Dookie know that you're a working person too. WD40.com. Stop on by.
Hello, this is Guy James, host of The Guy James Show. If you like factual, hard-hitting, liberal radio, yes, I said liberal, then I believe you'll like our show. We're a proud member of the Head On Radio Network, heard Monday through Friday, 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time at theguyjamesshow.com. You've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth.
Obey. That's right. Don't obey. All right, you're back on the Bruce Birch radio program coming to you live. This is our premiere show. Maybe I'll talk about that just for a second. This is our premiere show on the Head On Radio Network. Now, I used to have a show, on this network from 10 until midnight, 10 p.m. until midnight Eastern Time here on the Head On Radio Network called All Things Reconsidered. And that's no longer with us. It went away last night. As a matter of fact, at midnight, that was the last one you'll ever hear of those. I also do a show called Fourth Estate Radio that you can tune into on this very same stream from 10 p.m. until 1 a.m. And I do that show with a good friend of mine named John Fox from Sydney, Australia. If you're so inclined to pick up on that, you can go you can listen to that show. Also, you can go to the website, fourthestateradio.com. Now, very interestingly enough that today we would choose to premiere this show here at the Taking Back America Conference, because what I'm doing here is pretty much typical of what it's going to take to take back America. We have to get out. We have to change the message. We have to shake hands. We have to talk to people one-on-one. We have to create a new groundswell of progressive thought within the United States to bring us back to a place that's realistic. Now, as one of the guests, John Jovna, who wrote the book 50 Simple Ways, or 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Fight the Right, mentioned that the liberal left, those of us who consider ourselves to be on the left side of the political spectrum, were the impetus for everything from civil rights to the national park system to the 40-hour work week. And, you know, to allow the right to change the message, if you will, to hijack our message, is absolutely not acceptable, and we need to take that back. Now, if you were listening to the music that was coming into that break, that was Scott Ainsley. And Scott is one of those folks who has consistently been on the right side, which is the left, of course, of the debate with regard to the war, with regard to other issues related to social justice in the United States. And that song was off of his latest CD. You can go to cattailmusic.com, CATTAIL music.com, cattailmusic.com, and down. You know, I do think he has some of those tunes up there for download. If you're interested in doing that, you can get that. You can also order the CD from him as well. But he's a fantastic progressive out of Brattleboro, Vermont. Wonderful musician, and I did want to play that tune mainly because we do have coming up as a guest. We have Patrick Campbell, who is an Iraq War veteran, and he will be with us directly after we take this bottom of the hour break. And he is, well, we'll talk more about that. He just got back. He returned from Iraq in October 2005 after 1 year of service in Baghdad. So we're going to have an interesting conversation with him. He is a member of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Later on in the radio program, we have Clint Curtis coming up. And after Mr. Patrick Campbell, we'll have William McNary, who is the spokesman for Progressive America and part of U.S. Action. So it's going to be an interesting show for the rest of the night. If you want to get in on the program, you can do that. You can call 1-877-443-2366 if you're so inclined, or send me an email, bruce@brucebirch.com. And we're going to go ahead and take our bottom of the hour break, and we'll get back to you just as soon as we can. And coming up, the interview with Patrick Campbell. We'll be right back.
Radio Action, Michael Franti, Let us in, LZ in the place.
The area.
Gone International with Sly and Robbie on the track. Drums and bass. We get in wild. Check the phone. Just the last word. I don't understand the whole reason why you're telling us all that we need to unify. Rally round the flag and beat the drums of war. Sing the same old songs. We heard them all before. You're telling me it's unpatriotic, but I call it when I see it. When I see it's idiotic. The tears of one mother are the same as any other. Drop food on your kids while you're murdering the fathers. But don't bother to show it on CNN. Brothers and sisters, don't believe them that it's a war against evil. It's really just revenge engaged on the poor. By the same rich men, fight terrorists wherever they be found. But why you not bombing Tim McVeigh's hometown? You can say what you want. Propaganda television.
Every 3 minutes, another woman gets the news that she has breast cancer. And here are some of the first words she hears. HER2-new oncogene, aromatase inhibitor, ductal carcinoma in situ. What do these words mean? How are you going to decide what to do if you can't even say what you have? This is Olivia Newton-John. As soon as you get your diagnosis, you can go to breastcancer.org. It's a special place on the internet where you can learn how to say all those breast cancer words and find out what they mean. At breastcancer.org, you can learn more about your particular kind of cancer and your treatment options. Prepare a list of questions for your next doctor's visit and get all kinds of other useful information to guide you and your family through this. Breastcancer.org, the first place to go the minute you find out you have breast cancer.
Hey, John, I just heard you got a new computer. Congratulations.
Thanks. It's the coolest thing.
What will you do with your old computer?
I don't know. I guess I'll just throw it away.
Well, my company just bought new computers, and we decided to donate the old PCs to a place that gives them to local schools. You could do something like that.
Seriously, who would want a 3-year-old computer?
Hey, it might be great for someone else. Computers can be refurbished and reused instead of ending up in the trash. By passing it on, you can help the community and the environment.
If you're replacing your company's IT equipment or you're finished using your personal computer, pass it on to a local organization that accepts computers. To learn more, log on to epa.gov/pass it on. This message was brought to you by EPA, Dell, Intel, HP, NEC, Philips, and this radio station on behalf of EPA's Plug Into eCycling Partnership. EPA does not endorse any commercial services or products of these groups. For information on all partners, log on to epa.gov/plugin.
Planet Check.
He's the granola Ayatollah of canola. Charles Ford, founder of Grassoline Solutions, explains.
I just started writing rhymes while I was farming and doing the eco thing, so that's kind of how this all came about.
Ford spits the truth.
Now, Rudolph Diesel was no weasel, this we know to be true. He was an engineer and a humanitarian, too. He made it possible for us to drive on vegetable fuel. Nobody told you that, well, that's what I'm trying to do. It was back around the turn of last century when Dr. Diesel offered up this opportunity. Corn, soy, chicken, fat, some flour, flax, hemp seed. Farmers could grow their own fuel, not only their feed. Small towns could be self-sufficient about their energy needs without drilling or spilling or paying a fee. It's like that.
Biodiesel reduces cancer-causing emissions by 75%. For more eco-wrap and all the 411 on biodiesel,
Grassoline.com. Check us out.
That's Planet Check.
Planet Check is possible thanks to Clif Bar, the energy bar made with organic ingredients by a company committed to sustaining you and the planet. More at CliffBar.com.
Some prayers never reach the sky. Some wounds never heal. They still say someday the South will rise. Man, I want to see that deal.
All right, you're back on the Bruce Birch radio program, and sitting here with me, beside me, is a gentleman named Sergeant Patrick Campbell. And Patrick, welcome to the Bruce Birch radio program.
Thank you.
Wait a minute.
Oh, there we go. It's a pleasure to be here.
Somebody keeps turning off my mic, man.
Okay, they didn't want to hear what I was saying earlier.
I swear, this is the second time I've had to turn it on, and I haven't touched that mic, so I don't know what's going on over there.
They were afraid I was going to get quoted like, George Bush, saying, look who that's over there.
Well, first of all, thank you for your service.
Well, you're very welcome.
And being a part of the American military, and you are in the Army, or are you still in the Army?
I'm in the D.C. National Guard right now, serving.
Wow. So you are actually still...
Still in service. Still have a couple years left in my time.
What are the chances of you going back?
Well, the way it works is you can only be sent for 2 years in a 5-year period. So if they send me again, they can only send me for 8 months. So I think I have about 3 years before they can really send me away for a full deployment.
Did you, I'm just reading this a little bit here.
Just give you the story.
Give me a quick rundown.
I was serving the D.C. National Guard. I'm a law student out here. While also serving as a combat medic. About halfway through my first semester at law school, I decided that I was not in the right place. I was against the war, but as an individual, I didn't really feel like I could, protesting was not necessarily the best way for me to advocate that. So I decided to volunteer and go over to Iraq and try to bring as many soldiers as I could home as a medic. I got volunteered. Took me 6 months to find a unit. They randomly assigned me to the Louisiana National Guard. Louisiana National Guard, the 256 Infantry Brigade.
Wow.
I got assigned to an infantry unit from Brobridge, Louisiana. Needless to say, a California boy who was a former student body president at Berkeley, serving with a bunch of guys from Brobridge, Louisiana, was an interesting experience. They called me Tootsie. That was my nickname. But we got along well, and then we served a year in Iraq and Western Baghdad.
Wow. So what you're a medic, so you saw a lot of the guys who are coming through who had experiences with the IEDs and various things that were going on?
Lots of IEDs. I mainly treated gunshot wounds. Thankfully, none of my soldiers, my 22 soldiers that I was responsible for, ever got seriously injured by enemy fire. We did have lots of close calls. I actually ended up pissing on an IED on accident. I looked down and there was one right at my foot.
Oh, my God.
And I had a rocket land about 5 feet from me, but it just happened to be on the other side of a wall.
So enlighten me a little bit. We read about the violence that's going on over there, and we read about some of the explosions that are happening daily, and I think there was a statistic I saw the other day that said that there 6,000 civilians have died in the last 5 months. Is it really that violent still?
I mean, my last day there, we had 1,000 people die in one day, and that was when the bridge collapsed.
Oh my God!
And it happens. I mean, the reason why the bridge collapsed is there was a rumor that there was a suicide bomber on the bridge, and people just rushed. It was like it's like they talk about at these soccer games where people just pushing people off the bridge and the bridge collapsed under the weight, and 1,000 people died in one day, and they're still not talking about it because Hurricane Katrina hit the next day.
I've never heard of this.
Right. Well, it happened on the death of the 7th Imam. No U.S. troops were called in to respond. I was on patrol that day. That was my area. I would have been the first medic on the scene, and it was a political decision not to go in, and to this day I still have nightmares about that.
Wow. Now, as a medical you're not an officer, you're a sergeant, you're an enlisted man.
Enlisted, yes.
That's right. You're not one of those.
I work for a living.
What do you think is a realistic way? Or let me step back from that question for a second. I read a thing the other day about there's a guy who responded. One of the soldiers who had responded to an article in the Village Voice, and in the Village Voice article that he wrote, he said, if you really want to do something at home, get our leaders to tell us what the hell we're over here for. is there a sense of that in the military in Iraq right now?
Since I've lived in D.C., I have a good feeling of what's going on. But a lot of the people I was serving with from Louisiana thought that when we were going over there, we were going to find weapons of mass destruction. They honestly believed when we arrived that we were going to find them somewhere in the desert. By the time we left, they were very unclear why we were there, why we were sitting on roads just watching traffic go by. I don't think that they know. I mean, they know we're fighting for democracy, and they're fighting for projection of power in the Middle East. And a lot of infantry guys understand projection of power, but they don't understand any of the other finer points of why we're over there.
Does that frustrate them? I mean, has that contributed to some of the things that have happened, do you think?
I mean, it frustrates people because, I spent 6 months on a trash pile watching the cars drive by, and it's hard to kind of justify why you're away from your family for a year when you're literally just covered in flies, doing nothing, and thinking, God, this is a war, you're not advancing, you're sitting and waiting for things to happen. And there's not much else you can do because you're at a defensive posture, and it's a really hard and frustrating way to fight a war.
Would you call it FUBAR?
FUBAR, yes. Oh, exactly. I won't explain what FUBAR means, but it's something beyond all recognition.
Something beyond all recognition. Let's talk a little bit about, now I know this is sort of a difficult topic, especially for a guy who's in the military, but tell me a little bit about Haditha or if you can enlighten me personally and perhaps the listeners who are listening right now as to what could have motivated this kind of situation.
Well, I just want to take a second. I work for the Iraqi and Afghanistan Veterans of America, the organization I work with, and we definitely have two points on this. First is that it is not in the rules of engagement to commit the atrocities that have been described in the news.
Okay.
Second thing is we need to make sure that we're protecting these soldiers and actually give them a fair trial. We can't convict them in a court of public opinion, because the fact of the matter is there's a lot of decisions that are made on the fly that you need to have put them in the proper context.
Sure.
That being said, the thing I can tell you is the story while I was over there.
Sure.
There was a time where one of the patrols that had been hit twice in the last 2 days was driving up, and they got hit by an IED. And we saw the IED go off, and we responded. And this was the breaking point. They had been hit 3 times in the same street right next to a series of shops. And everyone in our unit knew that those people in the shops knew that there were IEDs there because every time an IED was about to go off, they would run in to the stores. It would give us about a 2-second heads up. So they knew the IED was there, and they knew who planted it. So, my unit decided that they were going to run over all the shops with our tanks until they told us. Now, here I am, as an E4 medic, a specialist, not even a non-commissioned officer at the time, standing up in my face of my first lieutenant telling him, there's no way we can do this because this is the type of thing that's going to be on CNN, and this is a violation of everything that we're talking about in our rules of engagement. Thankfully, cooler heads prevailed, but they got close to that point. They got close to the point where they lost control of themselves. And I can understand when you lose a soldier that, you want to inflict that pain on
revenge,
the people around you.
Right.
And it's hard because there isn't an enemy. You're shooting, being shot at, but you never get to shoot back. And it doesn't justify what happened, where soldiers were held to a higher discipline. As a medic, I'm treating both U.S. soldiers and insurgents. That's my job. It's our jobs to be better than the people we're fighting.
Sure.
But that we're being put in situations where, sometimes with a failure of leadership can just go incredibly wrong very quickly.
Is there any sense among the military that some of they call it sectarian violence, I call it civil war. Is there any sense among the military that that's actually occurring?
I left right before they really took off. Mm-hmm. The sectarian violence, civil war. I do know for a fact that people who are over there saying the locals are soft targets. We're riding around in fully armored Humvees that, 4-inch steel, whatever it is. While the police officers and the locals are driving around in pickup trucks. So it is so much easier to cause chaos, blowing up these people than it is attacking U.S. soldiers.
It's frustrating. What's frustrating is knowing that these guys who are over there are going out on patrol every day and they're doing their thing like they're told and being good soldiers and carrying out the orders that they've been given, and they go out every day. And that's opportunity. Hello, opportunity. Knowing that they're going out there and they're experiencing this tenseness, and day after day after day after day after day, that has to have a toll. Now, you're a medic.
Yes.
Are you also, have you also been trained in the art of psychology or dealing with some of the mental stuff that happens as a result?
We talk about post-traumatic stress as part of our training, but it's not a huge part of our training. It is part of our, as we come back, everyone's talking about it because everyone knows it's an issue. Some of the ways that we talk about it and we do it is not the brightest. For instance, my unit, the first thing we did when we got back, we were asked to fill out a survey. And the survey was to be indicators about post-traumatic stress disorder. And so our leadership stood up and said, this survey is about post-traumatic stress disorder. Please answer it honestly. But if you answer it honestly and you answer yes to any of the questions here, you will be held up later than everyone else. You will not go home to see your family for another 5 days after everyone else has already gone home. So they were asking the survey. They were asking the right questions. But do you think anyone in their right mind would have answered honestly to those questions?
Absolutely not.
Of course not.
Absolutely not.
And so it's about really thinking about, in a strategic way, ways to help people. Because all people want to do when they get home is go see their family.
Sure.
And giving people, and people who are going to seek out help are not the people who need the most help. It needs to be, constantly checking in with people a month, 2 months, 3 months later, providing those resources and not just giving, go to this website, go to this website, go to this website. Actually, one-on-one.
Go to the website.
Yeah. we have a website. We always say, just go to our website, iaba.org. But in the end, you need to talk to a person.
Absolutely. I've dealt with a lot of PTSD and post-traumatic or post-combat situations with veterans and guys who were in Vietnam and who did things that, I myself can only imagine what, being backed into a corner and being told this is what you have to do in order to survive or whatever. I just can't imagine having to put myself in that kind of position. So it's very difficult to place myself there. But I will say that, you know, the job that you guys are doing, despite some of the things that have happened, you know, which always gets the most attention, absolutely is within my mind is, you know, you're doing a great job, you know, and I want to commend you for that. We are going to take a very quick break, and then we'll come back and finish out the interview. I'm talking with Patrick Campbell, who is with Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Sergeant,
yeah.
Sergeant Patrick
just got
Campbell.
Promoted. Just got promoted last week. Maybe after this interview, I'll get back to specialist. But yeah. Who knows?
You've been talking about them. You've been talking them. They're communists, ain't you?
Yeah. You're not from California.
But we're going to go take a quick break. If you want to get in on the conversation, you can do so by dialing 1-877-443-2366, or you can send me an email to bruce@brucebirch.com. We'll be right back.
After the tsunami, it was ham radio that was on the air, saving lives. When Florida was ripped by hurricanes, the hams were there. In the critical moments after the attack of 9/11, it was the hams who coordinated emergency messages. When disasters strike, the hams are ready. Ham radio works, and other communications don't. To learn how you can become a ham radio operator, call the ARRL, the National Association for Amateur Radio, at 1-800-326-3942.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Want to fight childhood asthma? Then fight it with a scrub brush and a hot soapy towel. Even in the neatest and tidiest homes, if there's so much as a crumb to eat or a drop to drink, household pests like bugs and mice will do all that they can to get it. Creepy crawlies like bugs and mice are unpleasant enough as it is, but they're more than just a nuisance for kids with asthma because they can actually trigger an asthma attack. So, give them a whole lot of nothing. Sweep up crumbs, wipe down tables, scrub dishes before they pile up in the sink, and store leftovers in plastic bags or bowls. Don't leave them so much as one tidbit or nibble, and you can stop a childhood asthma attack before it starts. Discover other simple ways to prevent an asthma attack. Call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS or visit noattacks.org, because no child should feel like a fish out of water. A public service message brought to you by the U.S. EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
Hey, have you got a minute? I'm going to say a word. You tell me what comes to mind. Are you ready?
Okay.
Tchaikovsky.
Gesundheit. Okay, what's the word?
No, see, that is the word. What does Tchaikovsky make you think of?
I don't know. Allergy season?
Hey there, how you doing?
What's up?
Who's Martha Graham?
She invented the graham cracker.
No kidding.
Yeah. Before her, there was only soda crackers.
Hard to imagine. Hey, young lady.
Yeah?
Does the name Man Ray mean anything to you?
Duh. The Man Ray is a kind of poisonous jellyfish, and it lives in the Gulf of Mexico.
Aha. Uh-huh.
It's very deadly.
Are your kids as well-rounded as they could be? Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more about the value of arts education, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Tchaikovsky's music, Martha Graham's dance, and Man Ray's photography. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
Back on the Bruce Birch radio program, I am Bruce Birch, the fellow behind the mic, and sitting with me on directly to my left is Sergeant Patrick Campbell, who is currently in the Washington D.C. National Guard. He returned from Iraq in October 2005 after a year of service in Baghdad with the 256th Infantry Brigade based out of Louisiana. We were talking, about some really sensitive subjects, and you know, before we go too far, I really want to tell you that I am very grateful that you have chosen to come on and be as candid as you have been, because I know it's difficult, not only talking about some of the things that you've seen, but you know, you're still in the military.
I'm still in the military. Yep.
You know, has there been, you know, have you ever been told by any upper level officers or superior officers or whatever to not talk to the media?
Actually been pretty good about it. They knew when we were going home that there was no way that they could keep us from talking to the media, so they said stay in your lane, which is a military term for, you know, talk about what you know and try not to talk about things you don't. Now, my role with the Iraqi and Afghanistan Veterans of America puts me way out of my lane when it comes to, you know, medical issues. But the fact of the matter is, I study this issue, and hopefully I know more than the average Joe.
Now, you are currently a law student as well, right?
I'm a law student at Catholic University up in Washington, D.C.
As a soldier, here's the toughest question. Have you ever looked at what you're doing and said, okay, this is legal, illegal, right, not right? How do you deal with that?
All the time. I mean, there were a lot of times where things went down where I knew they weren't right, and I had to make a judgment. I told you I was assigned with the Louisiana National Guard.
Right.
And needless to say, from the very beginning, I was an outsider. They called me Tootsie, and it was kind of a joke. But in the end, I had to spend a lot of time, most of my 6 months, developing their trust. So when I started realizing what was going on with some of the other units, I realized that I was adding a lot to that unit in terms of being the compassion and the heart and connecting them with the local Iraqis. I'm the one who learned Arabic. I'm the one who got the soccer balls donated. We got, you know, 1,000 pairs of shoes.
Mm-hmm.
My role with them became to be their conscience.
Wow.
But at the same time, I couldn't call them out on everything that they did because they would have exiled me out of the unit. And so there were a lot of times where I had to just swallow things that I would not have ever let go in other points of my life and just let it go.
Really?
And it's still to this day hard sometimes. I still think about it a lot.
I don't want to like ask you this to characterize anyone by any stretch of the imagination. Did you in some of your travels in Iraq, have you ever heard, you know, the any kind of racial stuff or epithets or
from the American soldiers?
Yeah,
or from,
yeah,
all the time.
All the time. I mean, yeah. Well,
I mean,
okay.
I was my unit wasn't shy about it, you know. About
I was hoping that wouldn't be the answer, but
well, I mean, when you spend 365 days with the same four people on a Humvee, you know, they talk about the real world. They should talk about the real Humvee. You know, the people just start saying what they really feel, and I appreciate their honesty. I didn't appreciate what they had to say, but we fought and dragged out. And I think hopefully by the end of it, we learned a lot about each other's culture, and I hope I expanded their horizons a lot.
Did you actually go out on a limb and say, hey, guys, this is not okay to be talking this way? Or?
Yeah, there were certain words that got used, and I told them that wasn't acceptable. So they just, about 3 months later, they decided to start using every other word they could ever possibly think of it. And so
Besides that particular word.
So after a while, I didn't accept it, and they understood that I didn't appreciate it. But we came to an understanding that they knew that I didn't accept it, and I would call them out when I felt like they had gone overboard. Needless to say, when Hurricane Katrina hit, that was fodder for them, all you believe. But we, I'm glad I was there. I think I was there for a reason, and my reason was to be their conscience. One of the things that happened in the last 6 months we were there is, first 6 months we were patrolling villages, we were kind of all over. The last 6 months we had route security, so we parked in the same place every day,
wow,
watching the roads.
Okay.
Because we had so many shoes and clothes and toys donated, the kids really developed a relationship with me and the soldiers. Because we had developed such a good relationship, they started telling us where the bombs were. So the kids would literally go stand on top of the bomb and say, Kumbala, which is Arabic for bomb. And the last 6 months, while we were in sector, while we were aware of people who knew who we were, we never once got hit by an IED. Other guys who were on our patrol, same company, who treated the Iraqis differently, got hit almost once a week. And so, I mean, even if you play the numbers, like just completely by chance, it's not possible.
So would you correlate the way that you treated them to with that way? I mean, would you?
Yeah, I've tried to explain it away any other way.
So let's just, okay, well, if that were the truth, okay, yeah. I'm not saying,
I'm not.
If that were true, then that would completely blow the idea that it's only insurgents that are doing these attacks.
Well, the insurgents are still doing the attacks, but they know that certain people, like, I mean, me being a medic, I treated a lot of the kids. I helped get them shoes, and the local people would not stand for certain people being, certain units, where they still planted the bombs. They were still going to detonate mm-hmm. on us, but we were able to find out ahead of time where those were going to be, and people who might not have been willing to risk their lives to tell us where a bomb was for other units, for us, because of the relationships that we had built, were willing to literally go stand on the bomb and say, the bomb is right here, and so don't park here. And, those relationships were really important to us.
Well, and I think that's most important. I mean, in any kind of situation where you're going to be the occupying power, apparently we have bumper music.
Awesome.
You're listening to the Bruce Birch radio program. Thank you, Patrick, for joining me today.
Definitely my pleasure, huh?
So, and we'll be back after the top of the hour in the news. Stick around. We'll be back.
Tell me what's the reason. She went to see the doctor. Then she read a magazine. Forget the book I told her. Then don't want to hit my the book again.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
What's it like?
What's it like?
It's lonely.
It's really lonely.
I miss my brother.
I miss my brother.
I'm surrounded by other people, but it's not the same.
I've got other people around me, but it's not the same.
It's pretty scary, but I don't let it rattle me.
It's pretty scary around here, but I don't let it rattle me.
You always have to watch your back.
There's no one to watch my back.
I spend my whole day worried who's out to get me.
I'm always wondering who's out to get me.
But I can take care of myself.
But I can take care of myself.
No matter what, I'll keep my head up.
No matter what, I'll keep my head up.
It's not like I have a choice.
It's not like I have a choice.
This'll all be over in 5 years, 3 months, and 17 days.
This'll all be over in 5 years, 3 months, and 17 days.
Go to jail for a gun crime and your family serves a sentence with you. Something to think about before committing a gun crime. Gun crimes hit home. This message brought to you by Project Safe Neighborhoods and the Ad Council.
Mom?
Dad?
How long should I wait for you?
Mom?
If I'm at soccer practice.
What if something happens? Will you come get me?
There's no reason not to have a plan in case of an emergency.
Mom, if you're not home, should we go to the neighbor's house?
And some extremely good reasons why you should.
Can you tell me?
Everybody should have a plan. Take 5 minutes to talk about where you'll meet and how you'll get in touch with each other in an emergency. For other things you can do to be prepared, visit www.ready.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Level in 7 months. We'll have the closing numbers for you at the end of the newscast. More than 20,000 residents on Florida's Gulf Coast have been ordered to evacuate as Hurricane Alberto continues to gather strength. Weather forecasters say the first tropical storm of the season could begin dumping heavy rain by tomorrow. Autopsy results on the body of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi confirmed that he survived for about an hour after last week's bombing on the safe house where he was hiding. Today, al-Qaeda posted the name of al-Zarqawi's successor, although the man's name suggests he is not an Iraqi. At Camp David today, President Bush urged Iraq's neighbors to follow through on the $13 billion in aid they promised. He met with military leaders and Iraq commanders through video conference to discuss the future of Iraq. The meetings continue tomorrow. In Baghdad, 200 more prisoners have been released from U.S. and Iraqi prisons, including Abu Ghraib. It's part of an ongoing effort to promote national unity, but Sunni Arabs are demanding more releases as well as compensation for former detainees. In Afghanistan, 15 suspected militants were killed when security forces raided a southern village. An army general reported 25 people died in violence elsewhere and that the insurgents are better organized than expected. Thousands of British, Canadian, and Dutch troops are expected to be deployed next month to take over for U.S. troops. In Iran, police beat a group of women's rights demonstrators with clubs as they protested in the capital. Of the 200 protesters, one was injured and 20 were detained. They were demanding equal rights and that a law allowing men to have multiple wives be taken off the books. In the West Bank today, Palestinian security forces shot at the parliament and cabinet buildings and set them on fire. No casualties were reported. In Washington, a judge has scheduled another hearing on the domestic spying program for July. Today, opponents and supporters argued its constitutionality in court. Opponents said it violates the rights of free speech and privacy, while the Bush administration says the program is legal and necessary to combat terrorism. The FBI reports that the number of violent crimes in the U.S. rose last year for the first time in 15 years. You're listening to the Quality News Network. It's now 2.5 minutes past the hour.
In addition to producing and distributing the finest hourly newscasts in the country, the Quality News Network conducts interviews with 2006 candidates. We afford congressional and gubernatorial challengers of every political stripe the opportunity to illuminate their views and to demonstrate their character in a 20-minute network-quality interview. We perform this public service to enable voters to get a better listen to the people they might consider electing to high office. Because as Thomas Jefferson said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. If you want to know more about who is running in the November elections, go to qualitynewsnetwork.com and click on 2006 candidates. If we are to get America back on track, we need to elect people who can lead us in the right direction. Now, back to the news.
Monster.com has joined a growing list of companies being questioned about possibly backdating their stock options. The tactic is used to take advantage of a dip in the underlying share price. Real estate investment has cooled amid higher interest rates and home prices. A Moody's economist says housing prices will level or decline slightly, but probably will not crash completely. The president of the United Auto Workers is calling for universal health care coverage and changes in other policies. He says the changes are needed because of the decline of the big three automakers and the rise of Japanese automakers. Daimler Chrysler is recalling more than 100,000 2003 and 2004 Jeep Cherokee models because of a fire danger. The front seat electric heater may overheat and cause a fire. Daimler Chrysler may begin selling smart cars in the U.S. The tiny cars are sold throughout Europe, where they've been sold since 1998. A final decision is expected later this month. China has reported a record $13 billion trade surplus last month. Exports reportedly rose 25%, while imports rose 22%. Microsoft says it will release 12 security patches tomorrow. Most of the patches fix potential problems for Windows. Lightsweet crude settled at $70.36 today. At the close of Wall Street, the Dow was down 99 points, NASDAQ down 44, S&P 500 down 16. You can hear more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Kimberly White.
Roll up your sleeves and put on your gloves, because the work is just beginning.
Monday warrior, mean try. Today's Tom Sawyer, mean try.
It's time to turn the conversation to taking back America. From the crusaders who have drained our treasury, created needless wars, and expect the working people to pay for their billionaires' gains, it's time for the Bruce Birch Radio Program. Brought to you by the West Virginia Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. They are building the American dream each and every day. You can get in on the program by dialing in to 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. And now, your host, Bruce Birch.
I always feel like I need to come out swinging. That's right. You're back on the Bruce Birch Radio Program. We're back, glad to have you back with us for this 7 o'clock, this third and final hour of the Bruce Birch Radio Program from the Taking Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. And sitting directly to my left is U.S. Action President William McNary. And he's the president of the U.S. Action, and this is an organization that is a state-based organization. They have presence in 24 states in the United States. He's been called one of the most electrifying and inspirational speakers of our time. He leads campaigns to build a more just society, engage all Americans in our democracy, protect consumers and workers, and clean up our political system, which is what we need more of, seeing campaign finance reform as a civil rights issue. Absolutely. William McNary, welcome to the program.
Bruce, thank you and Ulysses for having me.
Well, the first thing I wanted to ask you about was your organization. You know, today we're talking about Taking Back America. Mm-hmm. What does your organization, how does your organization see that vision, and how do you guys see a way to do that?
Well, first of all, we believe that if we're going to have change in Washington, it's not going to come out here in the Capitol. It's going to come in the states. And that's why we are building coalitions in the states. We do it in three ways. Number one, we push for broad-based issue campaigns. The broader, the better, so that we can have the structural changes that we need. If we're going to fight poverty, we're going to fight for health care, we're going to fight for jobs, we're going to fight for energy independence, then we need to fight on a broad scale. The broader, the better. It attracts the most people. It's where the people are. And the people want a bold, progressive vision. But secondly, we also connect our policies to politics and our issues to elections. In other words, Bruce, if you don't do politics, politics will do you, is what one of our board members
says. That's a hell of a way to put it. That's true.
So I'm just quoting my board member, which I could have. It's Alice Palmer is her name. She's a former state senator in Illinois and a coalition member of ours. And lastly, we build coalitions of labor and progressive elected officials and senior citizen groups and healthcare activists, environmentalists, community-based groups, civic organizations. If you take that and multiply it times 24, you have U.S. Action. We're in 24 states with 34 affiliates representing over 3 million members, and we fight for power in the states.
Where's the largest presence you have in the states?
You know, we have, if you asking me to name, I'm like the president, and they're all my children, so you're asking me to pick which of my 24 children that I like the best. But if you want to know where, but in addition to being the president of U.S. Action, I'm also the co-director of its Illinois affiliate, Citizen Action Illinois.
Okay.
So I can take off my national hat and put on my state hat and say that. We do a pretty good job in Illinois, but the fact is that we do good work in Colorado and in New York, Wisconsin, and other states as well.
What have been your biggest challenges thus far?
You know, I think our biggest challenges is to fight for progressive values in a way which reflects our vision in a values-based way. For example, all too often, progressives, our problem is we generally fight what I call for the four P's. We fight for programs, policy positions, pieces of legislation or platforms or plans. I have a plan and the president doesn't have a plan. That sounds familiar. That sounds like a presidential candidate that we just had. Where the other side?
I was gonna do it. Yeah. You almost saw me there. I was about to do an impersonation, but I decided against it. We're not making fun of John Kerry today, are we? Or we're not gonna try to. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But the point I'm making to you is that, you know, with the other side, they basically fight for principles. They say this is what we are for, and they use their policy programs, pieces of legislation, and platform to get to a principled end. And I think we as progressives have to begin to redefine or define what we are for in a way that attracts people to us, as opposed to put us in these silos where either you agree with our policy or you do not. Just to give you an example, one of the things that we recently did is in November 2004, U.S. Action decided that we met in November 2004. We thought we were going to celebrate, but we met to we had registered 600,000 voters throughout the country.
Wow.
The second largest in the history of the country. We got out 1.3 million more. And everything we were told, if you have high voter turnout, progressives win, low voter turnout, conservatives win. Well, we had a high voter turnout and progressives lost. How did that happen? Well, one of the reasons that it happened is because we can no longer ever again, Bruce, while we went out and turned out, we let the presidential candidates control the message. We can never do that again. We have to project our vision in our values-based way. And one of the ways we did it in November 2004, we decided to take on the president on his number one priority, which is privatizing Social Security. We made a decision right there in November 2004. And we always saw this as not just another issue, but a unique opportunity to redefine the role of government
Sure.
in our society. And we saw it as an opportunity to do politics in a progressive way. If this is about, I got mine, you get yours, how much can I make in the last 5 minutes, how much can I make in the next five, we lose.
Right.
But if this is about who we are as a society, I am my sister's keeper, I am my brother's keeper, and mm-hmm. we maintain that mainstream view. So as far as we were concerned, when we talked about Social Security, we said Social Security is more than just a card in a wallet. It's more than a document. It's a promise that we make from one generation to the next, a promise that we will not allow this administration to break. If we talk about it like that, we can begin to attract people and say, I'm with you. I can be with you on that. And so we fought this in the states. Everywhere that the president went, we met him there in our states. He started off in North Dakota. We have an affiliate in North Dakota that met him there with 300 people. And I don't know if you've ever been to Fargo, Bruce, but 300 people in Fargo, North Dakota, is like 1,000 anywhere else. So that was his first hit. And then when he went to Florida, we met him there with hundreds more. And then we went to Arizona, we met him there with hundreds more. And it kept building and building. When he got a time, he got to Arizona. Al Franken met us there. And by the time he got to New York, his last ditch effort, by the time he got there, they had more people on the outside protesting against privatization than they had people on the inside.
Fantastic.
And so that's one way we took an issue and ran it like a political campaign, one seamless whole, from Social Security now to the emergency campaign to America's priorities to fighting for Medicare, Plan D, fighting against it, I should say, fighting for health care, fighting for immigration reform, fighting against this war, and then in 2006 fighting to elect those candidates who support oppositions. It's one seamless whole for us.
Are you guys going to be endorsing candidates?
Well, you know, U.S. Action as a national organization, we have a C3 and a C4.
Uh-huh.
And we generally don't endorse candidates, but our state-based organizations, which have C3 and C4, endorse candidates. For example, in New York, they've endorsed some progressive candidates. In Illinois, we've endorsed some progressive candidates. So we let our state-based affiliates decide what national
so
decisions will make.
Yeah, so it's more of a grassroots sort of bottom up, which is the way it should be, right? That's the way grass grows, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Not a top down. Or not an AstroTurf organization, a grassroots organization. Yes, sir.
Well, tell me about some of the voter. I want to get back to that voter registration thing, and the reason why I want to get back to, there's a couple things I wanted to talk about. First thing is that you said, you know, well, we've always been told that if we can turn out the voters, that's going to be in positive for the progressive side. Now, here in a little while, I'm going to have Clint Curtis on, who is standing and waiting in the wings. And here's a guy who hopefully will come on and tell us about how, you know, computer code can be written to change voting. Now, do you think that may have had anything to do with any of this?
Well, you know, there's an old saying that just because somebody is just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that somebody's not after you. I've recently read or began reading an article by Robert Kennedy that talked about how the election was stolen. And so I'm a firm believer that where there's smoke, there's fire. So I truly believe that we must be more vigilant about not just getting out the vote, but working with your next guest and others to figure out how we can overcome these technical odds. I mean, I don't mind being beat, but I don't want people to cheat me out of an election.
Yeah.
I know in 2000 that election was stolen. I was not convinced until recently that this other election was stolen as well. But even if it was not stolen, I mean, you know, there's three. I was told, and let's be clear, there were 3 million votes more that Bush got than Kerry did. And if we're going to just look on one state in Ohio, well, even if Ohio would have made the difference, and believe me, Bruce, if we could have turned Ohio around, I would have taken the win, just like they, you know, supposedly took it in Florida. But when you have a presidential candidate that gets 3 million votes less popular-wise, we would have been in a bad moral position of defending a candidate that won without the consent of the popular vote. So if we must be vigilant, yes, and we must make sure that not only do we vote, get out the vote, but they count our votes. They don't discriminate against our vote. They don't minimize, marginalize, and criminalize our votes. So, yes, I'm excited to hear about what your next guest has to say.
U.S. Action, you guys have done a tremendous amount of organizing in getting out the vote. In that organizing effort, is there a broader purpose?
Yeah, we fight for racial, social, economic, and environmental justice for all. Make no small plans, Bruce. They do not excite men or women's souls. But, you know, in the midst of that, another piece of our work, in addition to getting out the vote and registering people to vote, we must convey a broader context and create a real alternative. And again, in 2004, we went off, registered voters, turned them out, but we let the presidential candidates define and frame the issues. We can never do that again. If we had left this Social Security fight solely to the Dems at first, we would have gotten partial privatization, because many of them wanted us to soften the budget cuts portion of our message because they were looking to cut a deal
at
the end of the day with the players that they saw having to compromise with. Once we heard that, we decided more than ever to be even more firm on our stance against budget cuts, because we wanted to create the political space where they could come in and change the paradigm. We cannot see ourselves as just the ground troops for a particular party. We have to be the insurgents that expand the role of people in our democracy. We have to reshape the national debate. We have to redefine the role of government in our society. And as progressives, I think we should look to the values of the late Senator Paul Wellstone. He believed that every human being has equal worth. He believed that every human being has a right to live a meaningful and fulfilling life. He also believed that beyond our own individual self-interest, there is a common good that prioritizes our communities and our mutual well-being. And lastly, he believed that government should be an instrument to promote that common good. And we should look to those values as we begin to redefine America and take back America.
Well, that's fantastic the way you put that, and you're absolutely right. And one of the questions that I would have, though, is to follow that up, is that it seems like on the left that, the last couple of elections, that we would raise up a leader and say, this leader, for lack of a better term, is going to be the savior of the Democratic Party, and he's going to provide the vision, and he's going to provide this wonderful aura and this personality that's going to pull us up out of our hole, and is going to create this whole brand new change that we want. while the Republicans pick a figurehead, and their party, as much as repugnant as I find their stances on things, the one thing that I will give them is that they have a well-defined and well-refined message that we don't have. And so it's like they tend to, well, we have this ideology and we just need to put a figurehead in place who will, you know, who will help us achieve these aims. And on the Democratic side, the ideology isn't there, but the figurehead is. You
right.
follow what I'm saying?
I understand. You know, that's the same challenge, by the way, we had with this, going back to the Social Security debate. It seems like we on the progressive side, we have a lot of, I think, therefore, I am, you know, people in our midst, and as opposed to let's walk together, children, and don't get weary. So the challenge in our Social Security debate is we needed to have a movement which allowed people to think and be creative, but at the same time, we had to make sure that we were united around a disciplined message, and that's the reason it worked so well, a message that could be easily communicated by many different voices. And so it doesn't matter whether it was a student voice or a Latino voice or a woman with a baby on her hip voice. We all had the same basic discipline message, but because of the diversity of the people that the movement we created, we all fought for the same thing. And I think what you're saying is that we need to have a movement that is clear about who we are and what we stand for. If I can give you a quick summary of what we at U.S. Action
Please
stand
do.
For, we believe that every woman and man who wants to work is entitled to a livable job with a living wage, safe working conditions, and a secure retirement. But we believe that in order to get that job, that every child is entitled to a high-quality public school education, regardless of where they live or who they were born to. But, Bruce, what difference does it make if you're the smartest person in the world or you have the best job in the world if a major illness can wipe you out overnight?
Totally.
A major illness is the number one cause. No, the number two cause of bankruptcy now. Losing your job is the first.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's the number two job reason for bankruptcy. So we believe that high-quality, affordable health care should be a right guaranteed to all. And we have the audacity to believe that we can do it in an environment of pollution-free air and arsenic-free water and pesticide-free food. And beyond that, we need to change America's priorities so that the dollars that we spend do not go to unjust, immoral, and illegal wars, but go to making sure that we take care of our people here. And we fight for not unilateral, but we fight for intergenerational, intergovernmental, and international security for all.
Wow. He made me speechless.
That's pretty clear, though, right?
But your organization is fantastic. And, you know, have you guys done any work down in Louisiana?
You know what? We don't have an affiliate in Louisiana, but let me just tell you what Louisiana did.
Okay.
What Louisiana did, a lot of people said, you know, I call them chicken and biscuit-eating ministers that, you know, get up on the pulpit. Now, I have a dynamic pastor, by the way, and his name is Reverend Jeremiah Wright in Chicago.
Trent, okay.
He's a liberation theologist, so he believes that we take the church in the street to the people. But some of these ministers basically said that Hurricane Katrina was God's way of punishing gays and punishing the poor and punishing blacks. Well, if it was anything, Bruce, this was God snatching the covers off an administration that is inept, immoral, and corrupt. And so what Katrina did is to focus the attention on what is wrong, not only with America, but what's wrong with the people in charge. What we can do with Katrina as a lesson is to use that as an opportunity to fight for a government which unites us as opposed to divide us. And this is the kind of America we want to live in. What kind of America do we want? Do we want an America where we have people in poverty? I'm from Illinois, and we have over 500,000 people in poverty, more than in all of Louisiana before Hurricane Katrina. More than ever, we need to fight for a government that protects the weak from the strong, that protects everyday people from exploitation and the abuses of power. What that means is that we have a morals-based document in this country. We talk about moral values, and it's called a budget. And when American government makes the wrong priority, it's the American people that pay the price. We need to change America's priorities. And Katrina will show us the way to do that if we're smart and take that lesson.
What was really amazing to me about what happened there is that it was a perfect opportunity for a New Deal. it was a perfect opportunity for a Roosevelt type of program, a WPA, to be put in place to rebuild and to refurbish that city and create a brand new opportunity for hundreds of thousands of people, and it was squandered. And guess who's building that city now?
Yeah.
Undocumented immigrants.
Well, you know.
I mean, that's you know.
I think that surely the people who live in New Orleans should be the ones that are helping to rebuild it. But that being said, let us not necessarily use their wedge issues to divide us.
True.
The reason that most undocumented are coming here, generally the reason that most people leave their countries is one of three reasons: either to escape violence in the case of war, to escape religious persecution, or to escape poverty. And all too often, a lot of the immigrants that are coming to America are coming here to escape poverty. And so what we need to fight for as far as immigration is concerned is a fair immigration policy that, number one, that lifts wages for everybody. If you lower wages all around the world, then jobs go to other countries, and then you lower the American working standards. So what labor unions need to do is not just fight for higher wages here, but fight for higher wages internationally, because now we are into it, you know, things are going international. Two, we need to fight for the right to organize, and so part of the trade agreements that we've negotiated with some of these other countries forbid them from organizing and having a labor union, and so we need to fight for workers' right to organize internationally. And lastly, we need to take a look at these trade policies, the NAFTA and GATT that we have initiated, and make sure that we have environmental protections, that we have wage protections, child labor standards, environmental protections as well. If we do that, most people don't want to leave their country unless one of those three reasons I talked about, to escape war, to escape poverty, or to escape religious persecution. We can make it more comfortable for people to stay in their own countries. So that's our answer to the immigration.
I totally concur with you. And I'm one of the few people that's I took a hit early on with this particular issue, mainly because a lot of the, even on the left, it's, you know, there was a considerable amount of angst over the undocumented workers being here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you're absolutely right, it is a wedge issue. Thank you for being so elucidating with that. But I did want to, you know, we gotta roll out to the bottom of the hour break.
Mm-hmm.
Before we go, though, how can folks get in touch with you? Mm-hmm. How can they find out if they have a chapter in their state, right, and how can they get involved with your organization?
Well, www.usaction.org. That's the first step, and then you can go to our website and take a look at all the campaigns that we're involved in. But even if there is not a U.S. Action affiliate in your state, there are a lot of organizations that are doing grassroots work. Too numerous to mention. There's a Center for Community Change, there's ACORN, there's a lot of, there's, even if you're an environmentalist, it's the Sierra Club. So there's a lot of progressive organizations out there. Our goal, though, is we need to figure out a way that we can bring all of these organizations together to sit at the same table. A group called America Votes did that in 2004. Bruce, it was a tremendous amount of cooperation and collaboration and coordination like I've never seen. We need to do that bigger and stronger than ever. And so, but at the very least, we need people to be active in their local communities. We're going to do this the old-fashioned way. Yes, modern technology. Yes, you know, predictive dialers. But we're also going to go door-to-door. I was with President Clinton about 3 weeks ago, and he asked this one minister who didn't vote for him. He said, "Why didn't you vote for him? Why didn't you vote for us?" He said, "You know,
William and Mary, thank you for joining me on the Bruce Birch radio program, and I'll keep you in touch, and we'll try to do something here real soon.
And I'll tell that story."
Okay, and we'll get to the story.
All right.
Sorry
you
about that.
Thank you, Bruce.
Okay. That was.
Okay, listen up. If you're sick of hearing lies by right-wing corporate pukes who like to pretend they stand up for the working guy, then head over to the Cup of Joe radio show where the truth will hit you so hard you'll have to wear your hard hat. You can listen to the screaming audio at cupojoe.blogspot.com. That's cupojoe.blogspot.com. Now get back to work.
Guy James Means, straight talk, and great guests like author and reporter Greg Palast.
Do we have Greg on the phone?
Yes, we do.
All right, very good, Greg.
Greg talked about his new book, Armed Madhouse.
You'll see in the second chapter of the book about Big Oil that I was able to get the inside documents from inside the State Department for the plans for the oil fields of Iraq, which is, you know, what it, you know, it's about the oil. And you actually, you know, if you thought they had a secret plan, I go and get it.
Greg Palast, thank you so much.
Don't miss Guy James weekday afternoons, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Dog attacks and dog bites come in all sizes. Think your dog doesn't bite? Don't be so sure. Dog attacks are one of the nation's most commonly reported public health problems. Francia Smith, consumer advocate for the U.S. Postal Service.
With the summer heat and children out of school, the dog bite risk gets worse. But with a little care, dog owners can prevent most attacks and protect themselves too from the serious legal, financial, and emotional consequences that often result. Over half the dog bite victims are children. Any dog can bite for the first time, even with the owner there. So whether you are a dog owner or not, please take the time to learn about dog safety. Visit USPS.com and type the words dog bite into the search box for the links you need. You'll be glad you did.
This message is provided as a public service by this station and the U.S. Postal Service.
Back on the Bruce Birch radio program, and here sitting with me is Clint Curtis, who is running for Congress in Florida, in the 24th District of Florida. And, Clint, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, let's talk a little bit about the whistleblowing activity that you've done with regard to government corruption and vote fraud. You are presently a computer programmer?
Yes.
And you worked for
Yang Enterprises in Oviedo, Florida.
Okay, and within that organization, your job was to?
I was the head programmer, and I also provided the technology information to, you know, like Tom Feeney, the guy I'm running against, actually would come in and he would tell us the things that the state was planning to do, and he would ask, could we do them? And then I would say yes or no, and then he would feed us on how to get the contract.
Really? Now, what? In your capacity there, how did you become involved in or find out about the vote fraud that was going on?
Well, very early on, basically, I was working there as the head programmer, and he was the corporate attorney, mm-hmm. the company's head lobbyist, and incoming speaker of the Florida House. Kind of a cozy relationship to have.
Wow. And
so, well, it's Florida, so you can do that in Florida.
You can do it. Jeb World is my
you
friend.
You can do it in Jeb World.
From Tallahassee calls it. Yeah.
Well, he was Jeb's first running mate, so
okay.
He had special Jeb World privileges. So he would come in and he would tell us, you know, what they were planning on doing, and then we would tell him whether we could do it. And early on, he came in and he wanted a program that would be able, a prototype basically, would be able to allow a user to come up, hit invisible buttons, and decide who would win a race
okay.
on any electronic machine. And he wanted it to be... You seem shocked. He said,
corruption?
Yeah, corruption and vote theft. What a deal. And So he wanted it so that it was touchscreen capable. He wanted to make sure that it didn't have any extra things you had to bring in, no special cards, no special keyboards, just right there on the screen. And he wanted the source code to hide the flip, which, you know, you can't do. So I told him that. And so I built it thinking he wanted to stop vote fraud, because remember, Democrats were in power then, and the paper on what you would do, which all you really need to do is to have, you know, a printer attached to it, which gives you a paper ballot that mm-hmm. the person can look at.
Sure.
And it needs to be separate. You can't have the little toilet paper roll on the side, because anything that touches that computer, I can control.
Okay.
So once you walk away, I can do anything I want with it. So when you print the paper ballot that's separate, the voter looks at it, drops in a box, verifies, drops in the box, and then you take an audit and see if your paper ties to your machine later on.
Right.
So that would allow it to be audited. And the source code should be non-proprietary. It should be open source, that sort of thing, you know, the basic things. And I handed that to her, and she said, "You don't understand. This is for flipping the vote in South Florida." Just that blatant.
Wow.
So, you know.
And what year was this?
This was in 2000.
This was in 2000, prior yes. to the election in 2000.
Just prior to the election. This is September 2000.
So, based on that information, what did you do?
Well, I didn't think it could go anywhere, because in order for that to work, you have to have proprietary machines that no one can look at, mm-hmm. that gives you no receipt, doesn't give you any ability to audit it, and then they're going to tell you who won. Mm-hmm. Now, who in the right mind is going to let that happen?
Jeb Bush?
Well, yeah. In fact, it happened. It happened nationally. You have no way to audit how the vote goes. You might as well just call up the owner of Diebold and ask him to pick a winner, because it's just that simple.
Well, I think it is absolutely a travesty and an assault on democracy that we have privatized. There should be an office of voter something, you know, independent elections office. But so you ended up testifying before Congress about this.
Yes. Passed an affidavit to them, testified before Congress in Ohio, and took a polygraph test.
Wow. And how what was the result?
So far, nothing, because the Democrats don't have the ability to hold hearings. They don't have the ability to subpoena anyone. So it's easy for people like Feeney just go, "Oh, well," and let it go. I don't remember that ever happening.
Have you read the article by Robert Kennedy, the recent one that he wrote in Rolling Stone?
Yes, pretty good article.
What are your thoughts on that?
He did a good job. He's pushing it out to mainstream media. They will hopefully get enough people to look at it, understand it, and know that they're being taken. So it's a boon just to get it out there.
So the solution to this problem of our vote being stolen nationwide would be to have a separate paper ballot from the voting machine itself.
Right. Or you could go to straight paper ballots. There's a lot of people who do that. Mm-hmm. The problem with that, Americans are kind of in a hurry. So we want to know how the vote ended the minute after it ended. We don't want to wait, you know. We want fast cars and fast voting machines. So,
and unfortunately, all the people counting the ballots are 85 years old or right. older. I mean, that's another thing that amazes me is that, you know, the election in 2004, I was a poll watcher mm-hmm. for the Democrats. And I went out there that day, and it really surprised me. The lady who was there had to have been 85. I mean, she could barely walk, and she was the precinct judge. Okay. And you know, it just amazes me. And I think that there is a whole nother issue underlying all of our elections, is that we need younger volunteers.
Right. But if we hybridize it, where we have the electronic machine and the paper ballot,
mm-hmm.
you now have basically two sets of books created. So you can check the machine, and it also makes it tougher to stuff the ballot box, which is paper, because if you go in there and throw in a bunch of paper, your machine counts are off. You will notice it.
Now, would those pieces of paper perhaps have, like, barcodes, or how would they verify those?
Well, you wouldn't really have to verify it to the person. You could still have this be a completely blind election.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd have it so that you knew which machine it came out of. So you could then test what machine results it gave you. You know, Fred had 200 votes, Sally had 100 votes. Check the paper, and it should match.
Okay.
North Carolina actually passed a law that said... Mm-hmm. We're going to have that, and if it doesn't match and I have to do a full recount, whoever sold me the machine is going to pay for that recount.
I live in North Carolina.
Do you?
And actually lobbied very hard for the voter verified or voter confidence bill that we had passed.
Well, then thank you. You did an excellent job.
But I wrote letters. I mean, I did what a citizen ought to do, right? I wrote my congressman, congressperson. I wrote my state senator, and I said, if you don't do this, I'll show up at your doorstep and tell you to do it loudly. And they did it. So
anything to keep you off their doorstep. Huh?
That's right. That Bruce Birch guy. We got to keep him out of here. Stay down there in Greensboro. Well, tell me about this. I want to get over to, because you know it's 22. I want to get to your campaign because I think this is very important to me to see that someone who has taken a personal stake in making sure that corruption is lessened. We need those folks in Washington. Here in Washington, those folks, and I'm thinking, yeah. I'm still in North Carolina.
Well, Tom Feeney's kind of the poster boy of corruption now.
Yeah.
There's a list that gets put out by an independent group in D.C. called Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Government.
Washington, right. Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, in Washington, that's right. And they had a list of the 13 most corrupt congressmen, and Tom Feeney, the fellow I'm running against, also the guy who asked for the vote fraud program, came in number 3 behind Duke Cunningham, the fellow who's in jail now, and Tom DeLay, the fellow who will probably be in jail a few days later. So he's number 1 now.
There's a heavy hitters list.
Yes.
Of corruption in Washington. Tom Feeney. Now, have you already had your primary in Florida?
Have not had the primary.
When is the primary?
The primary is September 5th, so we're way down in the primary.
Way down. Okay. And, wow, that's only 2 months away from the election.
It is. It's very hard to do. So, you know, he has lots of money, and we need to get volunteers and cash together and make a point of this guy. Because if we can take out Tom Feeney and actually make a point to what he did, this will have national impact. It won't be a Florida race. It will actually, you know, let people know what's going on, and we can fix it.
Now, I'm going to assume, I haven't asked yet, but I'm going to assume that he's a Republican.
Yes, he's a Republican.
Why would I... Well, why would I have that idea?
Running mate of Jeb should have been a little bit of a giveaway there, but you never know.
Is there any Democratic opposition in your race?
Yes, far? I have a veterinarian who's running, but he doesn't seem to want to come out and debate or, you know. Well, he puts in like 10 hours a day, 6 days a week at his shop, but he's kind of slowing down my process of getting things done.
Sure.
I don't get the press from having the battle with him, and... You know, we don't get the money because people are waiting for the primary to settle. So.
Sure. Now, as far as that race goes, how heavily, or that district, how heavily leaning one way or the other is it? Is it pretty much a toss-up? Or?
We need to pull about 7% of the Republicans over. And so far I've been able, every Republican I've talked to, I've been able to change it because there's more going on. I mean, you know, well, you know, the state of affairs where, you know, we're in a war we shouldn't be in.
Absolutely.
There's corruption everywhere. The national debt is through the ceiling. You know, the welfare programs are huge because we've gotten rid of all the union jobs that used to cover for insurance and everything. So now the government picks up the tab. So these are kind of the anti-Republican Republicans that are in office right now.
These guys who are in office right now are not the same Republicans that my dad had when he was younger.
These are not your daddy's Republicans.
These are not.
Sure.
These guys, I don't know where the hell they came from or what, you know, it just amazes my father now, who's a lifelong Republican here in Virginia. After the election of 2000, or actually right before the election of 2004, he changed his party affiliation. Didn't quite go Democrat, but he went independent and voted against dear leader.
He's sneaking up on it. It's hard for Republicans. I was a Republican for 40 years before, I learned of Mr. Feeney and that what they were saying was not what they were doing. And before you could get away with it and say, well, the Democrats are doing this and stopping us from doing that. But there's no excuse anymore. They've had both houses. They have had the administration.
All three.
Right. They have everything going on for them, and this is the result we have. So, you know, you can no longer talk the talk if the walk is as bad.
It is, absolutely. Now, tell me about, so you're absolutely committed to requiring a paper ballot.
Yes, sir.
Everywhere. Now, would you see this as a national imperative thing to do, or would you see this as more of a state issue?
It's imperative to do it on a national basis. We should push this through so that there is some form of regulation. You know, states are inherently in charge of all of the elections. That's just the way it's always been. In fact, it even goes down beyond that to almost local, to county supervised.
Yep.
But what we've done now is the federal government has put this umbrella on that you must use these machines to cover this act. So they push down these machines that are not verifiable,
right.
And so now they control the machines. So if we want to win, we have to make a point to win. By 2008, it'll probably be too late.
You also want to revitalize NASA.
Oh, NASA's been gutted in our area. In fact, well, an interesting side story. The company I was working at had a fellow there named Henry Nee, and he was Chinese. He wasn't, you know, naturalized. He wasn't supposed to be here. He was basically an illegal alien. And all of the information that we worked on the NASA projects went straight to Henry. So I found out later through a person who worked there that Henry was basically a spy. I mean, that's what he told me. So I reported it, worked on it for several years. Finally, they did arrest him and a couple other people. And he admitted to sending missile technology to China 20 times that year.
Wow.
And the company still has a high security clearance because of Tom Feeney. And we've been gutted. You know, we're still running 40-year-old machines, whereas the space program in China, which now has technology just went right out the front door, is, you know, they're 5 years away from a heavy payload system. If they have that, they control space. We do not. And that can be very bad from a military perspective.
It can be. Tell me about, I'm seeing here on your campaign card, providing universal no-fault health care. What is universal no-fault health care?
Well, right now, we cover health care based on where you got hurt, not on who you are. So if we covered it only once so that, you know, you didn't have to have workman's comp, you didn't have to have medical on your car insurance, medical on your house insurance, medical everywhere else you go.
Mm-hmm.
So if medical was actually covered, you could bring the costs way down. We could also cover it by providing tariffs on the jobs that we've shipped out overseas. Because in order to be a strong America again, we have to bring back jobs that are worth having.
Sure.
You know, a lot of times you'll see the Bush administration has built 3,000 new jobs. Well, maybe, but they're minimum wage jobs without any form of health care, no pensions, you know, and we're trying to raise Social Security, no way of surviving after they're 65. We need to get rid of that and to bring back real jobs.
I agree. Totally agree. Now, you also say and eliminating the cost of business. Do you see this administration over the next 2 years working harder to privatize Social Security at all?
Oh, sure. They'll try and raid it. They basically raided the retirement system in Florida. When Tom Feeney was there mm-hmm. with Jeb Bush, they sold out our retirement system to Enron. And when Enron crashed, the retirement system crashed with it. Now, they had enough back money to keep it from completely going under.
Mm-hmm.
But it's short billions of dollars. And that money's never going to be able to be recovered. That is the same thing that will happen if you privatize Social Security.
Are they actually raiding it? I mean, you know, now I know that they were talking about privatizing Social Security nationwide at one point, and that, you know, at the last guest that I had on actually helped create a campaign to keep that from happening. You know, there's two ways that they can undo government. The first way is overtly, through the passage of laws and through, you know, convincing the American public that government's a bad thing, it's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
The other way that they can undo government is sort of a piece at a time, sort of under the, you know, on the sly, if you will. And, you know, I can't help but think that, you know, as Grover Norquist once said, that, you know, they don't want to kill government. They just want to, you know, make it so small that they can, you know, or make it so ineffectual that they can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub. Do you see that as a possibility? Do you see them, the current administration is sort of sneaky in an underhanded way trying to raid Social Security?
Oh, sure. That's exactly what they're doing. You know, when you try and say, well, we can make more money by letting the stock market take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's exactly what they did in Florida. They took it away from a government process of where they could decide where it went and make sure they were guaranteed funds, and they gave it to their buddies at Enron. Mm-hmm. And it went under. And it's the same thing that could happen with the stock market. In fact, the stock market right now has been going down every week. So if your money was stuck out there without any form of guarantees, without any way of doing anything,
mm-hmm.
your savings, your retirement would be going down.
Tell me about the securing our shipments coming into the country. I know that, you know, we had this recent one of the most exciting talk shows I've ever done was about the Dubai Ports World controversy. You know, one of the positions that I took on that situation was, well, you know, we're profiling. If we're going to allow the Chinese to run our ports.
And we do allow the Chinese to run our ports.
Why not Dubai?
We allow Chinese to run our ports. We allow the Arabs to run our ports. Even after the Dubai incident, immediately after that went away, and it did pretty much go away.
It did very quickly.
They quickly sold off more ports to foreign governments. In fact, Miami's port used to be guarded by the Coast Guard.
Uh-huh.
And all the shipments that came in, they would scan for nuclear material. It's now done by Hong Kong company. So we don't control that. So nuclear shipments get to come in, and the Coast Guard was not even allowed to continue. So it wasn't a cost issue, even. They just said, don't do it.
Well, and it makes you wonder whether or not the money is being laundered through Hong Kong, perhaps, and the original deal was still in place. It's just that there's a holding company holding, you know.
You have to wonder why. Why cut that out? And that's something we need to, you know, basically our ports should be secured by Americans with American companies or by the military, such as the Coast Guard, in the case of, you know, checking actually things that are coming into this country, because now it's not being done. But it's not being talked about either. It's kind of just moved away.
Immigration issues.
Immigration issues.
Okay. there's the hub.
We're covering anything.
I'm trying to, you know, I want to make sure that everybody, you know, is listening, knows your stances, because you're running for Congress. I mean, this is an important thing. We had a huge outpouring of support from the immigrant community and trying to, the Bush plan of guest worker visas and that kinds of thing. What's your feelings on that?
Well, first of all, I think we need to stop the bleed. We do have to secure our borders, and not just our southern borders, because that's actually racist. You know, we're saying, well, we're going to secure our border, but what we're meaning is we're going to keep the Mexicans from coming in.
Right.
That's actually what they're saying.
Right.
If we're really securing our borders for any sort of security, we might want to consider securing all of our borders, because we don't cover our southern border very well. 6 million people is an estimate that comes across every year,
sure,
back and forth. We don't cover our northern border hardly at all. We don't even know if anybody is coming across there. So if it's an issue of terrorists and that sort of thing, you know, if they can buy snowshoes, they're in. California coastline, there are 5 people that actually cover the California coastline, and they don't work nights. So what kind of security is that?
That's World Trade Center security.
That's pretty sad security. So once you stop the bleed, right now we have all these people, and they're worried that, you know, the families are going to be broken up, all this kind of thing, which, you know, you do want to prevent that, because people now have families here. You have to respect that. What we could do is set it up so that the people that are here can get sponsors, so that all those people that came out and marched and supported them would actually kind of adopt them while they were in the immigration process to come through the front door the way they should.
Okay.
Those that had no sponsors, and that would basically take the burden off of the taxpayer for all of the costs leading up to that.
Okay.
Their sponsor would cover them. Once they became a citizen, they're a citizen. Let them stay, leave them alone.
Okay.
The people that are that can't get sponsors, that are here just illegally, snuck across, you know, and they're just too much trouble for anyone to bother with, pick them up, send them back, you know.
Even if it means splitting up families and...
You won't be splitting up families because they'll find a sponsor. But, you know, we also get a good percentage of, and not a huge percentage, but, you know, a percentage of criminals, a percentage of, you know, the people who basically can't stay in Mexico because they made so much trouble they had to move.
Right.
So, you know, those people we don't want to keep. Those people will send back. And those people will not get anyone that will step up and, you know, come to the plate for them and say, we're going to keep you.
Okay.
Well, further, that will, once they get jobs, then we can put them into the real system. We don't need to have a subclass of person with a, you know, a visa process where they can work for 3 years at sub-minimum wage and then we send them home, because that's just crazy.
It's indentured servitude.
Indentured servitude is what we'll be doing there. So what we can do is have these people, and they will get real jobs with, you know, real pay and bring it up to the right levels, and they will have insurance and they will be covered, and that's what they need.
Well, and I think that, you know, it's a huge issue. and there's 14 million immigrants here who are, you know, or that's the
that we know of,
that that we're aware of, and you know, that's that number's been bandied about. I've heard 10, I've heard 11, I've heard 14, I've heard as high as 16 million. I don't know. But I do think that, that's going to be, you know, if you get elected to Congress, which I certainly hope you do, that, you know, that's going to be probably the hot button issue, because right now they're placing a panacea on this problem, on this situation, rather than really looking at a lasting solution.
Right. They're not looking to help anyone. They're looking to basically just make an issue of it.
Right.
You know, they're talking about, well, we're going to build a wall. So they're going to build a 300-mile wall on a 3,500-mile border. Someone might think of going around that wall.
You think?
I'm not sure, but I think that would happen. And then they still don't have the other borders covered. So is it a Mexican can't come in issue, or is it a border security issue? Because you can't have it both ways.
Yes, you can. We're getting right up to the top. Let's shift over to Iraq real quick. And we're going to be running out of time here shortly. But I just wanted to let's talk about what it would take to get out of Iraq, in your view.
Well, Iraq actually wouldn't be that hard to leave. We've actually done this before. You know, if we get over our John Wayne, we went in there, so we must stay. I mean, that's what kept us in Vietnam for 25 years, is that we didn't know when to say no. We just have had enough. You know, we build governments, you prop them up. The minute we left, well, not the minute we left. I think it took 2 months before they actually fell, when the last troop left, that, you know, it collapses, because it's considered to be a puppet government. Whether it is or not, it will be considered to be a puppet government, and they take them out. Iraq was made up of basically three distinct countries or tribes in World War I by the British. If we simply let them separate, like we did in Bosnia, mm-hmm. the fighting groups separate so they can get their cohesiveness, have their own time,
sure.
We can be out of there in a couple of months. And then they can come together the way they have to come together as a country. As long as we're there, we're just someone to hate. There's no way we can fix it. We did help break it, but we can't fix it.
Well, that may be the simplest solution I've heard yet. I actually had an Iraq War veteran on earlier, and you know, they're stuck in the middle of that and can't see a way out. And I think it's behoven, I guess that's the word I'm looking for. It's imperative that we get them out of there.
Right.
So, Clint, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon and this evening.
Thank you, sir.
And I definitely want to get your contact information. We'll have you back on the program again. You know, as we're take on the Reich wing.
Okay. I forgot to give the website, though.
Oh, yeah, please do.
www.clintcurtis.com. We need volunteers. We need contributions. I'm sure you've heard this before, but...
Send your money and your firstborn, right?
We need volunteers, because if we get a lot of ground support, we can make a difference. We can take this guy out, and that will make a difference nationally. We can actually do it.
Well, I wish you the best of luck, and we'll get back with you.
Okay. Thanks,
okay?
Sir.
Thank you a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And that was Clint Curtis, who's running for Congress in the 24th District of Florida and is a whistleblower for voting reform and very, very excellent candidate. The radio program this evening was brought to you by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. They are building the American dream, and by sponsoring the programming on the Head On Radio Network, they are doing that right here, helping us take back America. This has been Bruce Birch. I'd like to thank John Fox for announcing the show and for being the chief engineer of the Head On Radio Network. I'd like to thank Bob Kincaid for sponsoring or for producing the show. And I'd also like to thank all the interviewees who came on and helped bring this show together and made it a huge success. This is the premier show of the Bruce Birch radio program. I'd like to thank you all for joining me, and we will see you tomorrow evening, tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock. This is Bruce Birch, and remember, guys, this democracy belongs to you, and it's not a spectator sport.
Was a time I'll always remember. I could never forget how reality came down around us like some Western movie set. When the dust all settled, the sun shone so bright, and a great calm took over us like it was all gonna be alright. That's how it felt to be alive after the revolution. many a factory floor. The workers talked of solidarity and refused to build weapons of war. No more will we make missiles. We're gonna do something different. And for the first time, their children were proud of their parents. Somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried. After the revolution, prison doors swung open. Mothers hugged their sons. The Liberty Bell was ringing when the cops put down their guns. A million innocent people lit up in the springtime air. And Mumi and Leonard and Sarah Jane Olson took a walk in Tompkins Square. And they talked about what they do now. After the revolution, debts were all forgiven in all the neo colonies. Soldiers left their bases, went back to their families. A non-aggression treaty was signed with every sovereign state. All the terrorist groups disbanded with no empire left to hate.